This is Steve Maxner conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Peter Faber. I am in Lubbock, Texas. Mr. Faber is in Connecticut. And it is the 19th of July, year 2000, at approximately 9:15 Lubbock time. Mr. Faber, would you please begin by giving a brief biographical sketch of yourself?
Okay, my name is Peter Roy Ludwig Faber, born 1940, April 25th, 1940, in Staten Island, New York. Lived with my parents and grandmother to about 8 years of age. After my grandmother retired from a school teacher in the New York City school system, we moved to Monroe, New York, which is in the upstate New York, where I lived with her. My grandmother and my aunt raised me. My parents both worked in New York and came up on weekends. I went to high school in Monroe Woodbury Central High School in New York State. Drifted around a couple schools and ended up at University of Rhode Island, 1960, graduated in 1964, degree in agriculture, went into the Army at the conclusion of school. I was an ROTC candidate. Married life, I got married while I was in college. My wife had already graduated. And I've been married since 1963 and are still married to the same person. Two children, a daughter in Madison, Wisconsin, and a son in San Francisco, California. Their age is like 37 and 35 or something like that.
Okay.
I live in Winchester Center, Connecticut right now, and that's basically it. I'm still a member of the Connecticut Army National Guard. I'm a pilot. I just got a two-year extension to fly past age 60. Have been involved in the Guard since I got out of active duty in 1972.
What do you fly currently?
I fly a C-12, a Beech 20, BE-20, mm-hmm. Command and Staff plane. Essentially when I got out of college, funny enough, I was not what most people would consider a great ROTC candidate. It was a land grade school, and I had to, the first 2 years were ROTC. I basically played football at Rhode Island and track. And ROTC you had to go to, and you always could get an easy excuse from drill because you were hurt from football. And there were a bunch of none of the football players hardly ever made Wednesday drills. You had to go to class, but the Wednesday drill you never went to because you were too hurt to walk to parade. But of course you could go to football practice that day. It didn't matter. But actually, don't ask me why. I've often thought how in hell I ever stayed in the ROTC, but I applied for ROTC and got accepted into the final 2 years. I suppose I figured if I was going to go in the Army, because the draft was going in, it would just as well go in as a lieutenant as a private. So I went ahead and did it. And besides, as it turns out, being married, the $38 a month was a significant portion of our monthly income, like perhaps 50% of it.
Wow.
And, you could rent a cottage. We rented a cottage back then on the shore for $25 a month, the furnished cottage, so you can see what prices were. So that was, pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason I didn't go to summer camp between my junior and senior year, so I had to go to summer camp, after I graduated, and they withheld my diploma until I completed that. But I actually was looking at my transcript just a couple of months ago, and I probably have to be the only ROTC student that's ever graduated with less than a C average. I actually had two D's in there when I was a sophomore. But I ended up graduating as a distinguished military student and distinguished military graduate because of my performance at summer camp, where I came in, I guess, second or third in the class and did really well. And to this day I can remember I went back, I had to get my diploma from the military department, and there was the PMS, a guy by the name of Colonel Hamrick, I think, or something like that, was he wouldn't come see me. He had to send out, he sent somebody out with my diploma and just sent me away. He was so mad that I was a distinguished military student graduate. I still laugh about that. I went to Infantry Officer Basic at Fort Benning in November of 64. Mm-hmm. Was there until perhaps March or April. It was like a 3 or 4 month school.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been assigned to the 1st Division at Fort Benning at Fort Riley, Kansas. We couldn't find housing. The housing was full out there. We couldn't find housing. My wife and I had dogs, and she was pregnant at the time. We couldn't find any housing, any place that would take the dogs, so we ended up buying a house trailer and had moved out to Fort Riley. And she went out there with her mother, and I joined her from Fort Benning.
Mm-hmm.
It was March or April. I'm trying to remember, Jack. But it's and our daughter was born in May.
Mm-hmm.
Fort Riley, 1st Division. I was assigned to 2nd of the 28th. Infantry. I was assigned to the headquarters company, where I was the N-tank platoon leader, which was the wire anti-tank wire guided missile made by the French.
Mm-hmm.
SS-10, SS-11 were other versions of it. It was interesting experience. A lot of funny stories out of that.
Well, let's take a step back real quick.
Yeah.
And I noticed on your on the questionnaire that you filled out for me,
yep.
You put that you went to Fort Devens. Was that for your summer camp?
Fort Devens was summer camp.
Okay, okay.
That was the summer of
mm-hmm,
64.
Right. Okay.
And anyway, I was at Fort Riley, mm-hmm. and it was like perhaps July. We were getting ready. The division was getting ready to do some big mm-hmm. joint training maneuvers on the Atlantic coast with the Marines for an amphibious operation. Back mm-hmm. then, they were still stuck in 500,000 men assaulting rocky shores in small boats.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sent out to San Diego, California, to the Navy embarkation school to learn how to backload troop transports mm-hmm. with equipment and men, mm-hmm. so you offload them onto the landing craft and get them onto shore. And I was going to be the a loading officer for the, I guess it was the brigade. And
what year was this now?
That would have been 65.
Okay.
And while I was at San Diego, Vietnam was just sort of cranked up. In fact, mm-hmm. I remember right before I graduated from college, there was an ROTC graduate from Rhode Island that was one of the first people killed in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was a sniper or a landmine or something in a truck, but anyway, he was one of the first people that were killed. But at that time, in 1964, Vietnam was basically basically special forces and advisors, rangers in there,
mm-hmm.
and there was nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
While I was at San Diego, though, I got a fax in, or not a fax back then. I guess it was a Twix or whatever they stood for.
Mm-hmm.
That the 1st Division had been was set up to go to Vietnam. The 1st Division alerted, and we were put on standby status. All leaves were canceled. I was in the last week of school, so I finished school, but I came back straight away to the whole division was packing up and getting ready to go to Vietnam.
Okay.
I'm going
to have to ask you to take one more step back.
That's okay.
With regard to you mentioned that you in your discussion you graduated from IOBC at Fort Benning.
Right.
What did you think about the training you received at Fort Benning, the Infantry Officer Basic?
It was. I found it to be very easy. I mean, I was an honor graduate there, and it basically was academics. I found the whole Army education experience essentially to be, well, for two things. I liked it. I liked the shooting. I liked the, most of what you did I liked, and the book work that you had to do was relatively straightforward. I think the Army assumes that you're an idiot and teaches down from there.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, it was the class I went through was not to qualify you in tactics so much or anything else, but really was to qualify you in, was to get you army-ized, I guess. I mean, most of us were ROTC. We had no idea how to salute or anything. We didn't know rank. I mean, I knew rank, but I can remember one of our first classes was teaching us how to tell what the rank was of the officers. Probably one of the funniest stories I've related over the years came out of there. There was a sergeant that sort of looked after our company, and he got us on the bus in the morning and ran the administrative office and things, took care of all that stuff. And he also was in charge of giving us quick little army briefings. And it reminds me of the sergeant in MASH that drove those guys around in Japan when we were doing the operation on the kid. He's a goddamn army, you know. It was old crunchy guy, but he gave me one of the best advice he ever got in the army, and it was a terrible, absolutely terrible English. He said, but he stood up in front of us and said, "Now, if you guys don't remember nothing else, you's remember this. Don't ever go in no joint that ain't got no windows." And I'll tell you, in retrospect, I should say that was the best advice I ever got, because I've never seen a joint with no windows that I wanted to go in. But it was really funny. But that was, I thought probably the training got us ready to go into our units. Mm-hmm. We came out of there. By the time we came out of there, we were definitely squared away as far as the military procedures. We had learned the basics, but our training started basically when we got to the unit. Mm-hmm. I think it was an orientation as much as anything. It got us in shape, because some of the guys were not in shape. So you got a lot of running and PT tests and a lot of field work, and a lot of guys slept for in pup tents for the first time in their life, and it was a worthwhile experience, and it was a good way to get ROTC guys, college guys, into the Army. I'll tell you that. I mean, I felt, I guess if I was to do it now, if I was to be a teacher in those schools, I would feel sorry for the Army and having to take these ROTC guys and make them something military. Mm-hmm. It was pretty tough, but I always found military education relatively easy, the academic part of it. I don't think I ever took an Army school where I didn't finish in the top percentiles on the written exams. Now, that doesn't mean my physical performance was up to the, there was always some guys that better than that, but as far as the academic stuff, I've always found their education to be relatively easy. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter what school they went to, and it didn't matter if it was the Navy, the embarkation school, other schools I've gone to, flight school, I found the academics to be fairly easy. I mean, just all the way through, I don't think I'm a overly smart person either, so I don't know, maybe mm-hmm. They hit me. But plus everything was always multiple choice, mm-hmm. and some of them were pretty obvious multiple choice. Maybe I'm lucky and not smart, which I'd rather be anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'm
sorry, one more question about your IOBC.
Yeah.
The emphasis in terms of what you did learn about tactics and strategy, how much did they talk about counterinsurgency, counter-guerrilla operations, and things like that?
Very little. We did a little bit of it because Vietnam was just the first experiences coming back, and of course some of the instructors were in Burma and places like that, so they were they had that. But for the most part, it was really typical military strategies. Retrograde, the forward battle area, tank divisions, armies, all that stuff. It was basically what you would see today, which really is not being used today at all. I mean, it's essentially it was very formal. Insurgency, and the guerrilla operations, you talked about it, mm-hmm. And we actually did a couple of patrols where you tried to infiltrate, but that was about it. And that was more to do with small unit operations than it was to do with counterinsurgency.
Okay.
Most of that you got at as you went along with various
mm-hmm.
classes.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you got to Fort Riley and started going through, did your commander at Fort Riley have any kind of a training regimen, or did he hold classes or give instruction on different types of warfare and things like that? Or
well, at the time when I first got there, essentially you were you're in the battalion that
mm-hmm.
was you sort of got your unit and you did unit training and
mm-hmm.
they did field training. In fact, when my daughter was born, back then when kids were born in the Army, your father was not, you were not allowed anywhere near the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
You were met at the door and your wife was taken from you, and then you were advised, you were told to go back to your duty, and you would be advised when things happened. And I was actually out in the field making a rope bridge for a training film.
Mm-hmm.
I dropped my wife off at the hospital if I was going to stay, and they sent me off, so I went out to the field, and the mess truck came out and took me back in for the to see my wife and daughter.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, you did unit stuff, unit training.
Mm-hmm.
I was, as I said, the in-tank platoon leader, I had my hands full. They had made the platoon the dumping ground for all the people that were having trouble every place else, because they never did anything, why I got that, I don't know. I was looking for an infantry platoon, and I ended up with those guys. But it turns out,
mm-hmm.
it was a pretty good experience, and we ended up doing fairly well. I mean, it was as soon as I discovered that my platoon sergeant could neither read nor write, I understood why we were having problems. So
wow.
It was a,
did you did you instruct him at that point?
And yeah, we
in terms of literacy?
Yeah, I mean, actually it was interesting. It was the army considered it a missile, but they had all these missile logbooks that had to be maintained, which were very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was worse than any vehicle log was. It was, in fact, it was worse than an airplane log was.
Mm-hmm.
And all these special forms and this and that, and of course they were all screwed up. And I actually ended up going over to an artillery unit and getting a lieutenant that I'd met who helped us get our logs squared away. And I took care of the logs after that because there was no way that the Sergeant Cotton was going to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And we got some training going, and actually it was a small unit. I would guess I had maybe 10 or 15 guys, and we got some training going. We started to have some fun, and we got to the point that we requested and got some missiles to fire.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, as soon as anybody heard we were going out to the range, every colonel in the world had to go out there, and most of it, of course, they wanted to shoot it themselves. When you get three missiles for five guys to shoot, two colonels take two of them to blow up in the ground 20 feet in front of you. You know, it's you get sort of annoyed, but
mm-hmm.
But it turned out it was okay. We had a pretty good time. I look back and we went over. We were going to become I think they were going to make us the recon platoon when we got to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
but that never happened.
Now you're saying this is an N tank as in November?
TNK, I forget what,
mm-hmm.
it was a version of the SS-10, SS-11, which they actually used in the helicopters, and it was a wire-guided anti-tank missile. And it looked like sort of a little fat thing that had a trailed a wire behind it, and you flew it with a joystick.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to have visual contact with the thing.
Yeah.
And, of course, it was great if you flew it across desert, but the minute you got through any brush, of course, the wire would snag on something and
mm-hmm.
they break. And then,
mm-hmm.
of course, it was, it, that was it. It did what it wanted to do. Actually, it usually went into the ground immediately, but it was sort of a strange little thing the Army had for a while that I am sure in combat conditions would be absolutely as worthless as tits on a boar hog. I mean, it was just terrible.
Now, and you said that there were some humorous events that took place while you were in this platoon. Did they involve the actual missile or
no? They involved the people. Mean, it was we had Sergeant Cotton was quite a ladies' man, and I'd get these phone calls. And, hi, is Candyman there? And
Candyman?
I say, hey, it's Sergeant Cotton, it's for you. And he'd talk on the phone for a while. And he said, I'm going to lunch early, sir. And I said, see you later. Let me go. But I guess with the guys I've always had in my unit, my approach has always been, look, we got a job to do. And we get our job done. And if we're done, then I don't want to know. I just don't want you to get me in trouble. And so it worked out pretty good. I mean, everybody looked after everybody else, and it was really pretty decent. It was I can remember we were taking our missiles out to the range, and somebody told the MPs or somebody that these were nuclear capable. Honest to God, next you know, we have all these cars coming around us, and they want to know where we have, where's our movement plan, and where is the guards. And I'm saying, what the hell are you talking about? We have these four trunks in the back of a three-quarter ton going out to the range, and it was good. It was just we had a guy that was used to be always going hide, and we end up getting the guy out of the unit, but he was. He would disappear, and we used to play a game. I used to buy a six pack of beer for the first guy that could find where he was, and he would come, and these guys would scatter. He'd be in some other guy's barracks up on the top floor, sleeping on a bunk someplace, and these guys got pretty good on tracking him down. But it was a good. I mean, I look back at the first division, and then but once we got back, this was before I went to the embarkation school. I mean, once we got. I got back from San Diego in the Navy school. Of course, the whole thing had changed. I came back to a division that was on alert status. All leave had been canceled. They had flat car after flat car and box car after box car lined up on the railroad siding. Plus, we went down to Topeka. We were making and everything's changed. At that point in time, this would have been like maybe. June or July or something like that, late May maybe, we really started getting counterinsurgency. And at that point in time, the intanks were not going to go to Vietnam. They knew that. And they gave me, they put me in charge of the aggressor platoon. And I became the brigade's aggressor platoon. And I had to learn a little bit of Vietnamese, which I probably forgot. And of course, our job was to be the guerrilla and work with the as out there in the field and do the attacks and everything else and those ambushes and certainly I discovered from doing that was a far more effective way of fighting than anything else was, because we had a wonderful time doing it, and we boofed the unit up to about 35 guys, my platoon with about 35 guys, and more like a company then. And it was bunchly, some guys that were either not going to be deployed with division or were newbie in, and we wore Vietnamese-like uniforms, which we had our own barracks away from the place, and we had a good time. But that's when we started getting the classes, and they really did a lot of work on the whole thing at that point in time. But most of the time, really, as far as your day went, was spent in packing and drawing supplies and doing inventories and getting everything set to be shipped over to Vietnam, because we basically took everything we had and packed it up and put it into boxes and conics containers and loaded it on flat cars, and it went to San Francisco to be shipped to Vietnam. And at the end, it got pretty frantic, of course, you know. But I ended up getting assigned to the Division Advance Party, and I never understood how I ended up getting all these sort of what I consider neat things. I mean, it was, but I ended up doing that. But let me digress just a little bit. While we were two of the platoon leaders that was in my company was a guy by the name of Keith Fish and Hibbs, and I want you to remember those names because we'll get back to them later on. But these two guys were one guy Fish was a OCS guy, came up through the ranks, and Hibbs was an ROTC guy. And these guys were absolutely fanatic, gung ho. I mean, they went out and they bought all kinds of special gear, and they put scopes on it. We had M14s then, put scopes on our M14, and spent hours at the range. And they were gung-ho guys, but we'll get back to those. Hibbs ended up getting a Congressional Medal of Honor in Vietnam, posthumously, unfortunately, but that's how most of them get them anyway. But so we were sort of packing up and getting set to go, and I got selected for the advance party. So we ended up going to Vietnam in 130, and it was essentially the brigade. Was in a 130. It was a couple of jeeps and a 3/4-ton pickup truck, and about 25 or 30 of us. And we island hopped across. We left out of Topeka, I guess that was Forbes Air Force Base, and flew to Washington State, and then out to Hawaii, and then the Midway, and sort of took forever to get over there. It took us about 5 or 6 days to get to Vietnam. But we arrived, landed at Thomas Lund Air Force Base. I can remember that we had all our combat gear, and we were locked and loaded, and the C-130 taxis in and pulls into the spot. And, of course, the colonel had us all charge out and set up a perimeter, and we all run out the back of this 130, of course, with our M14s, and run out into the weeds and flop down and guard the airplane, right? And there's a bunch of Air Force loadmasters lying in front of themselves in the grass and looking at us and laughing like hell. Here we were at the Tonsuit Air Base. We ended up going over and setting up the staging area at the Saigon University, which is just right near Tonsuit. Not Tonsuit, Benoit, I'm sorry. We landed up at Benoit. I'm getting my years confused here. And Saigon University was just across from that, and we set that up as the base camp. I guess it was maybe 5 or 6 or 8 miles or so outside of Saigon, on Highway 13, I think. Setting that place up as division headquarters, and where the staging area was going to be, and then they moved the various battalions out to their bases. And we were there for a couple, 3-4 weeks before the division arrived. They had gone by boat, and we'd stayed around and shut down the base. Our various units turned the keys over to the permanent cadre, and then we went over and then flew over. And they came in by aircraft from Nha Trang. That's where the boats landed, and flew them into to Benoit, and we would haul them over. We'd have things arranged, trucks were arranged to get everything over, and then pick up the machinery and organize the convoys to get the equipment up and all that good stuff. Mm-hmm. And I guess we were around Saigon for not very long. Maybe from the time the division arrived, maybe a month at the most, probably a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And then the various battalions were set out, and most of the equipment that came in went directly up to the battalion sites. My battalion was sent to Lai K, which was about 18, 19 miles north of Saigon, in a rubber plantation. It was really a beautiful site. It was the facility we took over was the really the all the buildings, the main house, and the and everything else for the rubber plantation. Had a little airstrip there, and the battalions, the 1st and the 2nd of the 28th, moved in there, and we had our battalion had the west side, and the 1st and 28th had the east side, and that became the base camp. It was set it up. We dug our bunkers and what happened. I was at that time in headquarters company for the battalion, and I was trying to get an infantry platoon, but because I was doing all this administrative stuff, and when I went with the advanced players, they sort of kept me there, and I wasn't particularly happy. I mean, that was not what I like to do. I'm not a detail guy. My office here would clearly show you what kind of a guy I am. I hate the paperwork and all that stuff, and I do it poorly or late usually. But they were really because I'd been doing that, and I became sort of maybe the payroll officer and the currency exchange officer and all this stuff, and I really hated that. So within a couple of weeks of getting up there, and I was on fairly friendly terms with the battalion commander, a guy named Eisner, who was unfortunately he was one of the famous photographs in the news that came back, one of the magazines. He was killed by a sniper, and he was really he was a great guy. I mean, he was somebody that I really admired, and so I went to see him anyway, and I said, "Look, I really hate what I'm doing. I really want to get infantry platoon." So he said, "Well, I'll see what he said. I will put that out." Things didn't happen. I mean, I was a good scrounger. I would go down to Saigon and I'd scrounge up ice boxes and things like that. I was probably more useful to him doing stuff like that than anything else. But it turns out, I finally went to see my company commander and said, "Look, I hate this. I want a platoon. I got to get a platoon." There were a couple guys that were not doing well, and they didn't like it, so I ended up getting a platoon, Charlie Company, and I was really very, very happy. It was, I liked it. I hate to say that. I never once considered myself in danger. I never worried about being killed. It wasn't a possibility, and I wasn't young. I mean, I had been around. I was older than most people there. Because I'd taken a 6-year or 7-year route through college, just like my son did to me, which now I know how my father felt. I was like, you know, 25 I really enjoyed it. I wanted to do it. And now I get back to my two fellow platoon leaders, which was this guy, Fish and Hips. And of course, these guys I honestly believe that they were trying to see how close to the edge they could get. We did and they would volunteer for everything. Now I've never been a volunteerer. So for example, while my platoon always pulled their rotation on stuff, the old man would ask for something, and one of these two guys would be jumping up before the sentence was even out the guy's mouth. You know, it's like hitting the beeper on one of those quiz shows before the question is done, and they would volunteer their men for all these weird missions. So I never bothered doing that, and my guys thought I was great. They really thought that was wonderful. one of the first things I did, platoon leader, everybody thinks the Marines were the first people into Vietnam. Well, they weren't. The first division basically was. And we went over to the Trang, for the Marines to secure the beach, for the Marines to do a amphibious landing on the beach, which they did. And of course they came wading ashore, and all the cameras were there, and the news people were there, and we were sitting watching this whole thing.
I'm sorry, when did the first division get there? When was your what month and year did the advance party arrive?
We arrived. It would be late summer in 95, and then 65. Late summer in 65.
So July, August 65.
Yeah, I wasn't in the Army a year yet when I was in Vietnam.
Okay.
November of 64, I went on active duty, and by late summer of 65, I was in Vietnam.
Okay. And then the whole division arrived about the same time.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We actually the people spent the 30 days on the boat. We went by plane after they'd left. So we all pretty much arrived here. We were only in country a couple of days when the the boats. Let's say we were there a week when the boats boats came in and we started gathering and moving up.
That's when they arrived at Nha Trang.
Yeah.
Okay. What real quick question? When you stormed off that plane and set up your perimeter and Ben Hoa.
Yeah.
What was your first impression? You know, here you are. This is your first view of Vietnam.
I mean, I suppose we all expected that we were going to be shot at. I mean, we all were pretty dead serious. We had on our steel pots and field gear and everything else, and then when you get off there and you find that that there are these Air Force guys lying in their T-shirts in the weeds, sleeping and drinking Cokes. Smoking and joking and laughing and telling lies, and laughing at us. You look around, and after you were there, you realized that there was nothing happening. I mean, you could look out and there was farmers in the rice paddies and it was hotter than hell and I tell you what it was like. After we got set up, you turned your weapons in to drive into Saigon for an evening.
Okay.
And we used to do that. I mean, it was great fresh rental. We drove into Saigon, and it was like driving into a. It was a beautiful city, and it was clean, and all the restaurants were going, and they had, of course, the Rex was there, and they had. But you would go to have a great little French meal, and then walk around, and go into these joints, and it was still pretty much a cosmopolitan city in 1965, and it was like that for probably for a good deal of the time that I was in there the first trip over.
What did you how did you understand your unit's mission, and you know, what role were you playing in Vietnam, and what was the goal?
We felt that I believe that we were going over there to stabilize the country and allow it to become a democracy. That in fact South Vietnamese government was being threatened by the North, and it was sort of pretty much as you would think like Korea. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, in fact, our job there was to stabilize it and to help the South Vietnamese, people set up their democracy, and that was it.
Okay.
Quite honestly, I've always liked sort of banging around places, and my impression was of the Vietnamese people that really what they wanted to be was left alone. The average Vietnamese person was agricultural oriented. They had their little farms, places that they lived. They had a lifestyle that they'd had for hundreds of years or thousands of years, if not. And essentially, to the average Vietnamese, it didn't matter who was in power. It was no matter who was there, they just wanted to be left alone. And that was basically, why I sort of carried on. Now, certainly to this day, I do not believe the decision to go there to start with was wrong. What I believe was wrong was when was when you were not the military was not allowed to run it militarily. To give you an example, you had in our in Lycay we had a 175 battery, and they fired H&I, harassing and interdicting fire, and they were and they would use intelligence to pick up these places that were that they were movement, okay? And so first of all, they were dealing with old data, which probably meant them their chances were less than 50-50 that they were going to find anything there anyway. But essentially, H&I was supposed to be arbitrary and fixed, and the commanders could choose where they wanted. And the design was that it was arbitrary and unknown. Well, it turns out that after a while, because it was becoming a problem to other people too, that you had several days in advance, you had to submit the coordinates of where you were going to fire H&R, H&I fire, and where you were going to, and how you were going to, at what time, and how long, many rounds, or anything else, and you sent that up through a chain. Well, it went outside of the U.S. military chain and went into the Vietnamese chain, and essentially, well, I don't know whether this is true. I was told that eventually it had to be approved by whatever the province governors were, the military staff of the province that they were shooting in. So, I mean, so it takes 3 or 4 days for you to get approval of your H&I. Of course, by that time, every person in the world, I mean, I can, no matter what we did, everybody knew it. We were doing, you know, secret 3 o'clock in the morning departures, and we'd go out through the gate, and there'd be Mamasan standing there selling us Cokes. Now you tell me they just happened to spend 24 hours a day there? Bullshit. They knew what was going on. And so in essence, I think that had the, in the beginning, there was a military solution, I believe. Mm-hmm. It was not allowed to happen for political reasons. And I've got the, maybe not unique, but certainly I have the perspective of having been back to Vietnam in the late 60s and again in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw the process through a long period of time,
mm-hmm.
Including the destruction of the country and other things. And by the end, certainly I felt it was the only reasonable solution was to get the hell out of there, because it was obvious that it was never going to turn out the way it was supposed to. And I think I really believe that was a very high probability had you been allowed to do what needed to be done early on. But then it just became a war of attrition, and it was a shame. I felt sorry for the country, even though I don't really know if I want to go back or not now. I really felt sorry. But anyway,
let me ask you a quick question,
yeah,
about what you just mentioned. You said that you have early morning departures, I guess, to go on patrols or,
yeah,
for missions, and the Mamasans would be outside the gate waiting for you to sell your Cokes on your way out.
Yeah.
Well, were there Vietnamese working in your compound, in your base camp?
Yeah, but most of these things were really we didn't have a lot back in the early days. You didn't have a lot inside,
okay.
And they were not allowed to remain inside during the at night.
Mm-hmm.
Most of these things, well, we wouldn't hear about them. We know we were going to have we'd have a movement, and we wouldn't know about them until I went up for my briefing for the next day at say 6 o'clock at night, and I would get, and we'd sit down and we'd get the briefing, and here's where we're going, here's what we're going to do,
mm-hmm.
and we could be leaving at 3 a.m, we could be leaving at 9 a.m, it
mm-hmm.
depends, or we could be being lifted out someplace from the airstrip,
mm-hmm.
So you really wouldn't know where you were going until just before you went,
mm-hmm.
you only knew that you were going.
Okay.
Now some of the bigger things we did, you planned on them forever.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
you talked about them for weeks before mm-hmm. you did. Like some of the big operations that we did, and I forget their names now, but but the most of the patrols, the day patrols we did, you were really told just before you left. And but these were all, every place you went, essentially, you were being, this was at the end of that year. The first part, it wasn't that way. In the end, they always knew, somehow everybody knew where the hell you were going. And if the, and if they knew, who else knew, you know? Yeah. I mean, it's...
this was the end of 65?
Yes, it would be the end of 67. This would probably be the towards the middle of 67.
Oh, the end of 66, your year in country.
Yeah, I was in country from, I would say, let's say August of 65 to August of 66.
Okay.
Basically.
And when did you take over Charlie Company?
That would have...
Or not Charlie Company, you took over a platoon in Charlie Company.
Yeah, platoon in Charlie Company. That would have been probably in, well, hang on a second.
Okay.
Just hang on a second.
Sure.
Just say that was a bit about maybe October of 65.
Do you know what? Do you remember what platoon it was?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I could find out, but I don't remember what it was. I just don't remember that.
In October of 1965.
Yeah.
And what kind of operations did your platoon conduct in 65?
Basically, search and destroy and sweeps. The first thing we did was with the Marines. We did a joint, when they came ashore, we did a joint thing. And actually, that was generated from one of the funny stories, too. There was a guy that was, we were sort of this Marine platoon, and we got, a shot was fired, and everybody thought it was a sniper, and it was this little village there. And these Marines, they went into the village. They were all trained. They were trained for all this stuff. They were ready to go. And they threw a hand grenade into a grass shack because they thought that's where the person was. And there was nobody in there except the grass shack didn't stop much of the shrapnel coming through the walls. And these three guys were carted off with the Purple Hearts. It was a riot. We just laughed at them. But they went up north, and they went from there. They traveled up... up the shore, up to Da Nang, where they ended up, and then we went back, and then, and we finished a sweep through there, and which was over on the shore by just sort of north of the Trang, and we did a and that's where we had the first confirmed battalion kill. Up to that point, we really had not seen anything. It'd been virtually nothing. We'd had. A lot of landmines. We had guys killed already, but really there was almost nothing. There were a few odds and ends, some people wounded, but we never knew what we did because everything was at night. It was strictly harassing stuff, and it was this guy Fish who got the first confirmed kill, and with his M14 and his scope on it.
Okay. And
we picked up a lot of stuff. Anyway, and another story comes out of this thing, which was this guy, at that point in time, and I may be losing months here or so, but I mean, it's the city of Birmingham, Alabama adopted the 1st Division, and this guy, Hibbs, in part of the stuff that they'd gotten out of this little village they got into, they got a hell of a lot of really good intelligence information, supply lists, all kinds of stuff. Of course, among it there was a North Vietnamese flag, and so he scoffed up this flag for himself. But that's something that you just don't keep. I mean, he hung up in his tent. So the word got out that and all that stuff was supposed to be turned in, right? Well, the papers and stuff were, but he kept the flag. Well, the word came out that this guy had this North Vietnamese flag, and at that point in time, the sergeant major of the 1st Division was retiring, and he was being sent, and was one of his duties on his way out was to go by the city of Birmingham and bring back a trunkload of mementos from Vietnam for the city of Birmingham Museum or whatever they're doing there for the 1st Division.
Yeah.
And so the word came down through to this guy, Fish, that it would be very nice if he would give this flag to the to be sent back to Birmingham. And because he told him to pound sand. And then the word came down a little more forcefully that not only would it be very nice, but it was actually mandatory that he give this flag to the to be taken back to Vietnam. So he had no option, actually, because it was supposed to be, it was intelligence material, right? So ended up having a little ceremony. And we had this sort of a nice officers' club. It was one of the older buildings on the plantation. And so we had this little ceremony where he gave the flag to the company commander, who gave the flag to the battalion commander, who gave the flag to the brigade commander, who gave the flag to the division commander, who gave the flag to the sergeant major, and saluted him and said, "Sergeant Major, take this flag back to the city of Birmingham with the best wishes of the men and women of the 1st Infantry Division." Mm-hmm. And then we had a little reception afterwards. And,
okay.
And of course, this guy, Fish, was getting a good snoot full of beer because it was free, and we all pretty much did that. It was free. You drank a lot, and he's over there sort of chuckling to himself. And I said, "What the hell are you laughing about?" He says, "You gave up your flag, which you swore you never would." You know, mm-hmm. And so he says, "Go over and look at that flag. Go look at the corner of that flag. You're going to see it. Over in the corner of the flag, it was this little initial sewn in there." And I came back and said, "What?" They said, "That's a phony flag. The real one I shipped home. I had that one made in Saigon." So apparently, the flag in Birmingham is a handmade flag from Saigon that he had made for the occasion. But
oh,
it was
funny.
Really was. Well, yeah. I mean, it was the mission we did was essentially search and destroy, mm-hmm. just sweep missions.
Yeah. Now, what were the rules of engagement as they were presented to you?
If you were shot at, you shot back. But that was, it was not, it happened so rarely. I mean, I say, you know, and it's the same, I'm sure it's the same for everybody. I mean, here are all the great fights. I mean, the 1st Division had a hell of a good, I mean, we had a hell of a good fight in our battalion, but essentially you're out there walking through the bush. Most of the casualties we had were landmines. And things like that. It was just you'd go out. It was sort of alternated. You'd spend a couple, 3 weeks doing day sweeps, go out and back. Then, alternating in there, you'd get some night patrols stuck in there where you'd go out and set up a listening post or something. And then you would do a couple of days out. The day trips were usually in the form of platoon size operations, company minus type things, maybe two platoons or something, and the overnighters were usually company or larger, and we probably spent about half the time outside the base camp and the other half inside. Longest trip that we had was about 35 days, maybe 40 days. Went up to the Michelin Plantation and was on the road for about that time. We did have a week or so at an artillery base camp where we sort of rested for a bit. But for the most time, we were just walking. You'd do 20 clicks a day, 25 clicks a day. You carried your food. We would get a hot meal every day at either lunch or dinner time. Lived on sea rations. My platoon sergeant, my first one was Sergeant Lynch. He lived on beer. He didn't like sea rations, so he had his socks filled with beer. You always carried lots of socks. That was the only thing you really worried about was your feet.
Mm-hmm.
Underwear. You could always tell the new guys that they'd go out with a pack and they'd have change of underwear and stuff like that. Well, you never bother with underwear. You may put it on when you walked out the first time, but after 4 or 5 days, you just put it into the cat hole with your daily dump,
mm-hmm.
and left it buried. But you always carried socks, and you always washed them. You know, change your socks a couple times a day, wash them, in a stream or something, and you hang them on your pack to dry. And the guys that were really, I mean, what you ended up doing was you'd keep your sea rations stuffed in your socks, mm-hmm. and they would hang off the back, and they would, and then when you stopped, you had sea rations. He kept his socks filled with beer, so he'd stop, and we'd stop for lunch someplace, and Sergeant Lynch would drink a couple cans of beer, and off we'd go. but it was most of the stuff was just sort of sweeping through.
There wasn't any concern that might impair his judgment?
No. Not at all. Not a bit.
There weren't any regulations against that?
Yeah, I'm sure there were, but he was a good sergeant. Mm-hmm. He was a combat experience in Korea. Mm-hmm. He was I don't ever recall him being remotely impaired in any way, and it was something that I had no problem. I mean he ate too, but I mean essentially he did not he liked his beer, and that was it.
How about the other soldiers? How did they respond to that?
No problem whatsoever. I mean it was much different. It was beer was very common. That was not considered anything. I mean I'm sure there were army rules, but I don't say he drank. I mean, probably in the course of a day, he maybe only drank four or five beers, but mm-hmm. that would be over the whole day. I mean, it's not like he was drinking. I mean, he couldn't carry that much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whenever we got someplace, that was basically it. He used it instead of water, basically.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That was never entered my mind, and he was. And Sergeant Lynch was a good person to have around. And my next sergeant was Sergeant Humphreys, and he was a good person to have around too.
Mm-hmm. When you would come across, or did you ever come across, a Viet Cong soldier or a group of soldiers that didn't fire? You said the rules of engagement were if you fired, fire back.
No,
if they were fired upon. Did you?
We never actually. The truth is that we never. Only one time in my trip over there did we run across organized units of any kind. Most of what we ran into were snipers and things like that.
Yeah.
The 1st Division, probably our battalion's greatest action, you want to call it, it's not the right word exactly, but the most involved action was one that we had just north of our base camp, close enough so that the 175 could reach us. So it's whatever their range was, just barely. We were too far for them to safely shoot to the side of where we were, but they and we had A1Es were in there doing their thing and F-100s. But but for the most part, it was within probably 15 or 20 miles of the camp where we woke up, and it was pretty much everybody the same. In large units, you'd set up a perimeter, and then in the morning you'd all dig in, and in the morning you'd get up, and the helicopter would come in and drop off whatever they had to drop in for the day, and they'd leave, and then you'd fill in your foxholes, and you pack up and get ready to move out for the day. And this is the event where Hibbs got his Medal of Honor. He had volunteered his platoon had done a night patrol, and when he came back in through the perimeter in the morning, we don't really know what happens. We thought that he'd probably miscounted his troops, forgot to count himself or something. Anyway, he went back out. He thought somebody had fallen asleep and he left them back there. So he went back out himself. And what was really happening was during the course of the night, the Viet Cong and the regulars had basically surrounded this basically almost a battalion size perimeter was just waiting for us to fill in our foxholes. And the minute we filled in our foxholes and had no place to go, because we were out, this was out in the ladder right flats, you know, we were wide open. They were prepared to attack. Well, when Hibbs went out, he stumbled onto a patrol moving up and opened fire on them and sprung the whole thing early. And we were all, you know, the whole battalion was still all dug in. And the firefight lasted for into the afternoon. And amazingly, to the best of my knowledge, there wasn't one single American killed in that whole thing. And I don't know where this fit into the scheme of things, but it was, to my knowledge, it was the first time that we had run up against the regulars. And when we finally found Hibbs, he'd killed just a whole bunch of them. He was surrounded by them, and he'd gone out with a blaze of glory for sure. But if that hadn't happened, I don't know what would happen. I believe myself that if he had not miscounted and gone out there and stumbled on these guys coming up into position and opened fire on them by himself, that we probably would have been massacred because they were totally surrounded. And it went on for the whole damn day. I mean, it was... Fortunately, the 175s could reach it, and the A1E, of course, they got about 4 hours over the site, which was fantastic. And then they just disappeared, and that was it. It was over with.
How large was your unit there?
A battalion minus.
Okay.
So it would have been three companies. Yeah, three companies, four. Plus we probably had a few recon platoons, things like that. But it was.
Did you have a confirmed enemy kill?
We did. I have never. I never believed them anyway. But I don't know. But it was a lot. I mean, it was a lot of. It was the first time we really got into it.
Mm-hmm. Now, and was this? What about at the platoon level when you would go out on your patrols, your search and destroy missions,
yep.
Sweeps? What was the largest unit you, as a platoon leader, ever encountered?
It's hard to say the exact number. I would say that probably five or six.
Okay.
And I would usually have maybe 20 of us out there or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was almost always total insurgency type thing.
Mm-hmm.
A few shots, maybe a couple mortar rounds and then some few shots. It was really very, very spotty, and you might go along for ages and have absolutely nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I always described it as hours of boredom separated by moments of stark terror,
mm-hmm.
which I guess it's a pretty common description.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very interesting. Of course, back then it was really a beautiful country. There were a number of things that, for example, they did this thing, and I believe that the word they used was levitate. They used CBUs, and of course you had the elephant grass. It was really tall. It was 8, 10, 12, 14 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that was a great hiding place, and they used to go in with these CBUs, and they would drop them. And CBUs are those little cluster bombs,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they would just drop them over this area, and it would mow it down. It was like some giant, humongous lawnmower went through there. Of course, they failed to calculate that a goodly percentage of those little buggers don't go off, so nobody in their right mind wanted to walk into the damn place.
Mm-hmm.
But they used that to open up like a fire break almost, where they could. And then what would happen is you'd have a couple of platoons from each battalion would sort of start a sweep, and they would work. It's like driving pheasant, and you'd sort of sweep towards this area that was opened up, and the other people would be sitting up on the other side or something. And, you know, you did a lot of stuff. They'd lift you back and forth with helicopters and what have you. But we never saw a whole lot. The worst small action that we saw was this was up in the Mission Plantation, and our recon platoon had... They had called in, and they were under attack, and then we lost contact with them, and they sent my platoon out to relieve them, and we could hear the firing after we were have been walking for a while, maybe a half hour or so, we could hear it, and then it stopped. And we ran into some light sniper fire, but essentially there was nothing, and we found in a recon complete, all the guys had been killed. They had all jumped into the same the plantations had these trenches that ran down through the trees for drainage,
mm-hmm.
and they had taken a sniper fire in front of them, and it all dived into the same trench, and at the end of the trench was a guy with a machine gun, apparently, and they just they had no place to go. It was just brutal, but it was
how many men?
9 or 11 or something like that. That was the first time that we had ever really we had the odd guy killed,
mm-hmm.
but that's the first time we ever saw what you would consider a lineup of casualties.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the most sobering time I had over there, and some I don't remember about very often.
Yeah,
which is fine because that's what you don't want to remember. You remember the funny crap that goes on. I mean, I had a machine gunner, and you talk about the funny things. He was from Detroit, and he had a he was a big guy. I mean, he was a big muscular guy, and he had the largest penis that you'd ever seen in your life. I mean, you took a shower with him, and you would look at him, and you'd look at yourself, and you'd say, "Why did God make a joke of me?" You know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, he was out taking a dump in a cat hole, and a sniper shot him. And the sniper shot, and it went, and the round went through the calves of the upper thigh,
mm-hmm.
of his legs. And when it went between right and left, or left or right, whichever way it went, it just nicked the head of this cock. And we hear this terrible scream, and this guy comes running up, holding onto his cock,
uh-huh.
in his hand, screaming that he's been shot, and he's been shot in my dick, I've been shot in my dick. And we jump on him, and of course the back of his legs are a mess.
Yeah.
This guy is one big guy, and we hold him down. We get him sort of bandaged up, and get the helicopter come in, and we load him on, and off he goes. And we didn't expect to ever see him back. Well, apparently it was like a lot of things. It looked much worse than it really was, because
mm-hmm.
he was back in about 4 or 5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, where this thing went through, where it just nicked the head, it grew this knob of scar tissue, which the Army said they were going to take care of. But anyway, this guy, we had this little company club. It was just a GP medium with an ice box in it and a couple of tables, and he could sit there and drink sodas or beer at night. And we get these new guys in, and he would, at the drop of a hat, he'd pull this sucker out and slap it down on top of the table and say, "Yeah, man, they're going to love me in Detroit. The only guy on the street with a built-in French tickler."
Oh,
I mean, it was... I had this other kid that came in, and he was a really, really nice kid. But he was something... There was something wrong with him. First of all, we'd go out on a day trip, and by the end of... By the end of the morning, he'd be perspiring profusely and would be limping, and we'd end up carrying him back. So the first couple of times we carried him back, I went to the old man and said, we can't do it. This kid can't do it. I said, first of all, I don't know how the hell he got in the Army. He got this deformed leg, and he's limping, and we can't be taking him, because I can't be carrying him around for the whole damn day when he passes out. He can't take the heat and everything else. So we got the doc down, Doc Klein, and he interviewed the kid, and he came back, and he said, "Look, I don't know how this kid ever got in the Army. He's probably got an IQ of about 90, 85 or 90. He had a broken leg as a kid, and it had not healed properly. It was off-centered." So he said, "My recommendation is to just have him do something up here in the company and leave him alone and keep him away from sharp weapons that includes from any weapon. He said that includes sharp weapons like knives and forks. Because he was always losing his gun. He was leaving. He'd forget where he put his rifle down. So he ended up being a permanent garbage can guy, and he was happy as could be. I had a guy by the name of Lewis that was also carried an M60 for me, and he'd come in. I mean, he'd get an award for bravery, and he'd be busted at the same award ceremony. Practically, when we came into base camp, he would disappear, and he'd go out, and he'd be shacked up with somebody for the whole. But he'd always show up in time to leave. I mean, I don't know how he probably got it from his marmoson, the lady he was living with. But we had a couple of we did a lot of hops around the helicopters, getting kicked out. We went into one hot LZ where I ended up getting my Purple Heart. We lost my company. Pretty much my company. I was the only officer left, and almost everybody else was carried out. Nobody. It was only a CO was killed. There was a few guys killed. The guy Lewis was killed. He was my my radio guy, and he was standing in front of me, and he took a round right through the radio. And if he hadn't been, it was really just amazing. And what I got was just purely. I mean, I never left the field. I mean, I had. A couple of bandages, and I left. I mean, I stayed there. I went back in. When we got back in, they pulled a bunch of shrapnel out of me, but nothing that was more than, four or five stitches or something. But it was that was the only time. And what had done the worst damage was to the company was we got airstrikes coming in, and we had. And we used color smoke, and we had used purple smoke for the medevac, and then you use whatever else you have to get the airstrikes in on you. And we had F-100 was coming in, and the guy was told the wrong smoke. Or he got screwed up, whatever it was, and he came in on our medevac smoke and dropped his load on top of us, mm-hmm. And that was a very bad day there. But after that, we did regrouped, got a lot of new guys in, of course, and you had to start training because by that time we really hadn't had. Any mass casualties in the company at all, and it was so suddenly everybody else came in new. You had new CO and mm-hmm. all kinds of new guys in, and you started from scratch again. We had we did a sweep where we ended up going through this village, and we had taken all kinds of rounds out of the village, we ended up spending the night outside of it and waiting for somebody else to come up to help us out. But of course, by that time, everybody was gone. The place was empty. We found this little pig, and a little piglet was in a jar. And I also got some of my Vietnamese crossbow and a slingshot and stuff, which we carried around. Mm-hmm. So this was one of our big long sweeps. We were on the road probably for 3 weeks. And of course, we had this pig, and we decided we were going to make this pig our pet, a little black and white piglet. And so you started carrying, and we fed him sea rations. And then during the day, we take turns. Everybody took a shot at carrying the pig. And of course, by the end of 3 weeks, this pig had gotten bigger than he was at the beginning, and it got to be pretty damn. And actually, by the end, we were thinking about not getting him back to base camp at all. But we got him back to base camp, and we named him George after our CO, George Daly, which is the guy that was killed. Mm-hmm. He lived up by the mess hall, and he grew to be a good-sized pig. Anyway, a couple of drunk guys came back one night, and they were farm boys from someplace. They decided that George needed to be castrated, and they tried, and we caught him, but George had been cut up. So we had called up Doc Klein, a surgeon, battalion surgeon, who was a nice guy. And he came down, and he didn't have the faintest idea. So we got the the division vet on the phone, and he told like Doc Klein what to do, and he stitched George back up. And when I left, George was still there. Big pig. George was not a Vietnamese pot-bellied pig. He was a big pig.
Mm-hmm. But now, take a quick step back and ask you a question about the when you mentioned the Hunt LZ where you were injured, where you got
Yep.
Purple Heart. What was the purpose of that operation, and how long did you actually end up staying in the field?
We went into the we were going into a search and destroy. It was I'm trying to remember we were being inserted by Huey's into this. It wasn't a rice paddy area. It was a dry area, and we were going to be the hammer of a search through the this is sort of just towards the river the Cambodia side of the Mission Plantation, and it was just sort of a routine thing that we've been doing for. You know, off and on the whole damn time, and the first ship went in, and he was ahead of the rest of us by a bit, and then he lifted off, and there was probably three or four ships around the ground, and when it just as they were touching down, they just opened up on the LZ, and. Two of the helicopters stayed there. They didn't get off the ground, and the rest of them couldn't land because the LZ was pretty much was blocked up. They got one more ship came into the side, and they kicked some more guys out. But what it basically you had six Hueys had dropped off, and you carried 8 to 10 guys in a ship. So you figured you had maybe 25-30 guys on the ground, and. And we had the cover overhead, and we called that in immediately, and the old man was already on the ground, so he was he had been hit right away. I mean, he was one of the first guys that had gotten hit, and that's when we called in the F-100. We had two of those guys up above, and the first guy came in and dropped their load out just where we were looking for on the perimeter. And in the meantime, we'd also had the medevac was coming in. They'd gotten space cleared. There was one helicopter that couldn't fly, but they moved it away, and the other one was shut down and set there. And so we had room to get the medevac in, and that's when the second bird came in and dropped his load on top of us. CBUs, if I remember. And thank God it was. Thank God it wasn't napalm or something. But and that was, you know, just a full cover of the whole LZ practically. And, you know, it was just, it was pure blind luck whether you got it or didn't get it. I mean, it was like, you know, it's like being shot at by a shotgun and not having any pellets hit you. You know, mm-hmm. it's lucky. And but by that time, we were able to get the medevac left, and he didn't get hit. It was a strange thing too. And they got the hell out of there, and they got a couple more helicopters in. And but by that time, the thing was over. It was basically over when the F-100 showed up. But I felt sorry. The F-100 pilot really, you know, apparently he ended up going to the hospital and seeing everybody that was in the hospital and writing to everybody that was killed and. It was like, I don't know whether he flew or not again. It was, that was tough on him. Mm-hmm. But I guess that would have been probably in May or something of 66.
Okay.
Sometime back in then.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember or did you ever ascertain the size of the enemy unit that it attacked?
No. Never idea. I doubt it was humongous. It was probably just scattered out shooting. They did have some heavy stuff. They did have some 50 calibers or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We had by that time we were carrying an M60. We were carrying 60 millimeter the mortars, and mm-hmm. everybody carried four or five rounds on their backpack, and so we were we had that going by then too. We either shot out of a helmet, you know, just put the helmet on the ground and put that in the helmet with your hands, mm-hmm. and just dropped the rounds down, and you got pretty good. You got the guys that were did that got damn good on where they put that sucker. It was mm-hmm. amazing. Little 60 millimeter mortar. We used that a lot at the end. That was something we carried around, and everybody took a shot, myself included, carrying the tube,
mm-hmm.
and you just sort of rotated it off. The only guy that didn't carry the tube was the two M60 guys. They mm-hmm. they figured they had enough to carry because
mm-hmm.
we made them carry a lot of ammo.
Yeah.
but I guess, you know, I mean, if some of the things you think back at some of the funny things, I can remember I had this old sergeant. And he didn't know. He talked with his gravelly voice, and he'd been in Korea, and we'd hear it. He'd call me up. Landline would crank, and I'd bring up. And he'd say, "Lieutenant Faber, they're coming through the wire." I said, "What do you mean coming?" His name was Smokey. "What do you mean coming through the wire?" He said, "They're coming through the wire." I said, "Well," so we'd call up, and they'd pop a flare. There'd be nothing out there. And pretty soon you hear some shooting going on. You go down there, and you'd run down to the perimeter, and you'd say, "What's going on?" He says, "They're coming through the wire. We drove them off." Well, actually, this went on. It was sort of like the Chicken Little, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Finally, he called one night, and he called back. He said, "There's a tiger. There's a tiger in front of us." And everybody laughed then. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was so. But so you hear a round goes off. Damn, we go down there, and there was a tiger.
Mm-hmm.
The tiger was gone, but there was blood, and there was tiger fur where the guy had jumped off. But Smokey ended up going back, and we ended up getting a monkey at the time and named him Smokey because he was, I don't know, we all liked the guy. And so. And but Smokey used to take a fancy to the old man's tent. He'd go up there and trash the old man's tent. And one day we got told that if he ever caught Smokey in his tent, he was dead. And one day somebody, one of the guys came running up and saying, "Smokey's gone, Smokey's gone." And we headed for the old man's tent, and we heard a round about halfway up there, and that was the end of Smokey. But the, at night we got fair amount of mortars towards the end. In the mm-hmm. beginning, there was none of that.
Mm-hmm.
On the field, we would occasionally get mortars mm-hmm. At night. Not often.
Mm-hmm. How about friendly fire incidents?
The F-100 would have been the only one. We had a couple of short rounds on the from artillery, but nothing that was. I guess you'd call that friendly fire, but it was really just a short round. A lot of accidents, fair number of accidents, you know, guys tripping and shooting a gun off and things like that. But, no, I really, with the exception of the F-100, mm-hmm. that's the only experience that I personally had with friendly fire.
Yeah.
That was... that I wasn't happy to see. I mean, it was something we got pretty close, and I was very happy to see it. And yet again, you say that, and except for that one time where we got sort of surrounded,
mm-hmm.
I doubt if we ever had huge numbers that we were facing, probably no more than we were.
Yeah.
It was just in the bush, you know, it was just there would be, and they'd shoot a couple rounds, and you'd return fire, and the guys got pretty good at moving around. I'd never recall anybody that was worried or anything. It was, and they did their job, and you'd go there, and you'd find where they had been, and they were gone.
Mm-hmm.
The most common thing was these landmines, things like that. I can remember we were doing a patrol along this railroad, abandoned railroad, and we had our position set up there, and I bet you all of us had walked up and down this one little trail 50 times, and one day, I mean, it was only there for 2 days, and nobody had gone in and out. I mean, we were there, and there had been this mine there. Nobody had stepped on it until the last. We're leaving, and one guy stepped on the way out. And I bet you we'd all step on 2 or 3 inches of it at one time or another. Could have been anybody in the platoon could have got it. That was the biggest problem you had. a few booby traps. You ran across these primitive things that really, you wonder if they were just for effect. They never expected to get anybody. You know, spike things sticking out and what. Yeah, but it was pretty. Overall, it was pretty boring. I mean, you think back. I mean, it was. I can remember we were in this fire base up at the Mission Plantation. We're playing cards on top of a bunker, and in fact, it's the only place I have a picture of me. Of all my trips to Vietnam, of being a crew, my own picture of me is there. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, the guys I'm playing cards with get this expression on their face, and they just jump off and run like hell. And I look around, and they're sitting up, looking at me by a good long. It couldn't reach me. Was this humongous cobra, probably about 30 feet behind me?
Wow.
And because I took off too, and then we tried to catch this. We tried to get it because it took off like a shot. It was gone.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, it was everybody. Joe, we had one snake bite over there, mm-hmm. and that happened in the base camp, and the snake had gotten into a guy's boot, and he put his boot on, and he got bit.
What kind of snake was it?
No idea. It took off. It was a small snake, and so they had two kinds of anti-venom they gave him there, and the guy didn't even leave YK.
Wow.
It was, he did the next day when they hauled him down, but he wasn't even gone for, I mean, he was back in a couple weeks walking.
Mm-hmm.
But the worst fire ants, you know, they used to have these ants that made their nest in the trees, and they would kill you. Somebody would snap a branch back, and they'd have a nest in it, and it'd hit you, and it'd come down on top of you. You end up stripping your clothes off to get the damn things out. They chew you up like mad.
Hmm.
It was, I don't know, it was, I look back at it, and I gained weight.
Hmm.
I love sea rations. I gained weight. I can remember we were out someplace, and a helicopter came in, and it turns out it was the DePew. At that time, he was the assistant division commander.
Mm-hmm.
And we're sitting around, of course, everybody jumped. We hadn't seen a general in the time we'd been over there, right? So we all jump up, you know, and he looks at me, and he asks, how long I've been a platoon leader. I told him. He said, you're pretty big to be. I said, I like sea rations. I gained weight. In fact, I was out on a mission, and we were being resupplied at this little air base with by caribous, and the guy that was on there with the stuff they're bringing out was looking for me, and I ordered to go back and take my flight physical to go to flight school. I was supposed to go to flight school from the 1st Division, but my orders were more than 90 days from the deployment date, so they canceled my flight school orders and sent me to I was ROTC flight.
Oh, okay.
And so I had the deal I had was to, I got my private out of college, and I was told to go to flight school. But I got canceled. So when I went back to Vietnam, when I came back from Vietnam, it was I went back to flight school. But I mean, you know, I guess, let's see, I'm trying to think. Most of the officers ended up bringing private sidearms with them. I had a Walther PPK, and most guys carried private sidearms. Very shortly after arriving there, we turned in the M14s and we got the M16s.
What did you think of the M16?
It was a good gun. We had some of the ones, the early ones, didn't have the follower to seat the bolt. That changed very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
They had a thing about automatic weapons, and we were never allowed to have any ones that could be fired automatically. But not that it really mattered. I thought it was good. I mean, we had no problems. Had more problems with the M60, but that more depended on the gunner than anything else. If the guy looked after it, if he cleaned it, we ended up, everybody carried, you know, after a while he had the plastic bags over the muzzle,
mm-hmm.
to keep the crap out of the muzzle. I don't ever remember. I don't remember having one misfire on me.
Mm-hmm.
Carried the M40 grenade launchers. We had had a couple of odds of, we had two or three of those that we'd scrounged up. Yeah, you end up carrying a lot of stuff that wasn't TONE.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't carry many clothes. He carried, I said, carried basically socks, and that was about it, as far as clothes go. You wore what you had on your back, and you washed when it rained, and it, you smelled after a while that nobody bothered you.
Mm-hmm.
You smelled the same as everybody else. It was fine. But some private sidearms, you had scrounged. We had the 60 millimeter. A few guys had traded for odds and ends that they had. It was sort of where nobody. We didn't have flak vests back then. He didn't wear flak vests. He wore a steel pot, which actually, we had one guy got a horn shot right into the what would have been his forehead,
mm-hmm.
but it had to be slightly off. And the round went through the steel, but stayed between the steel and the liner,
mm-hmm.
and splintered up things, and the guy had some superficial cuts on his forehead and the side of his head, but he lived.
Wow.
We're talking about superficial, and
mm-hmm.
and that guy wore that helmet from that point on. He,
mm-hmm.
he got a new liner for it, and he wore that helmet with
mm-hmm.
a hole in it.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about the guys, and I had a bunch of good guys, you know, men. They were, I think we all got along. There was a fairly normal mix of black and white.
Mm-hmm.
There was...
any racial tension?
Not that I ever recall. If there was, I was oblivious to it.
Mm-hmm.
My guy Lewis was my RTO. He was... We lived together. I mean, it was really. I don't recall any problems like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, essentially the deal was that everybody looked after everyone else, and everybody just wanted to go home. I mean, it was it was two things you look forward to: your R&R and going home. And
mm-hmm.
and the goal was to see that happen, and that was my goal. That's why I never volunteered my men for anything I didn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't put them any more in harm's way than I wanted to put myself in harm's way. And yet when we ran into situations, I can't ever remember where I found anybody that I thought did something that was stupid or wrong. They all knew their job, and if a sniper went out, I didn't have to tell anybody to do anything. The guys that were doing the wings were immediately moving with their partners, and it was all pretty good. I mean, there was nobody moaned about doing what had to happen, and we're all grateful for hips and fish. They were all of it. I don't know. It was time to look back at. I mean, I could tell little stories that I remember as dead forever about the things.
Mm-hmm.
I did my R&R that year. A major that had been my instructor in ROTC,
mm-hmm.
was in Thailand as the advisor to either the King's or the Queen's Cobras, which was an elite unit in the Thai Army. And I went over and basically spent my R&R not living with them, but seeing them every day. And because we were he was a nice guy, and we knew each other, and he was just spent the time. But most of the guys in my unit, they wanted to go either Singapore or Hong Kong, someplace close and quick, and where they could spend their money in a real big hurry and get back there, right? But for the most part, I think it was my turnover. I would guess I probably had five or six guys that were killed, and maybe another. I probably rolled my platoon over. Well, I was the platoon leader of it, maybe twice.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been as far as count goes, but there was three of us that were in the platoon from that. Well, you know, they were there when I arrived into the platoon, and we went home together, and this the whole time. And that was fairly common. The most, you know, I mean, that was basically, yeah, we had probably as, I probably lost as many guys permanently to VD as I did to death, you know. So,
what would happen to those guys?
I don't know. They would go. We had our brigade commander was a guy by the name of Broadbeck, I think, or Broderick or something like that. I think it was Broadbeck. And this guy was religious. And he decided that that there was too much sin and sex going on, and that our VD rate was too higher. Our V rate was about 6%, which wasn't too bad at all, actually. Mm-hmm. They have higher rates than that in Europe at the time, I think. Anyway, he decided that it was that if the men couldn't buy rubbers in the little PX store, that they wouldn't engage in sex. Now, it has to be one of the greatest military intelligence stories you want to say in your life. Mm-hmm. So, of course, our VD rate went to, you know, to skyrocket. Mm-hmm. He pulled them out of the PX. But most guys got treated, and that was it. I mean, it came back. I was never. We had the one guy that got something that was nobody knew what it was, and he never came back. But I mean, he fought that for ages, and they finally sent him back. But I personally was always worried about something that was uncurable, and I didn't want to, and I never really, I was abstinent from my time there. I didn't want to bring anything home. I didn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understood. Mm-hmm. I mean, certainly you go to you go out of the country R&R and you're a grunt, and married or unmarried, you could always. Yet I never did. I say that, and I never once thought. I tell you that right. I never once thought about it. I could possibly be killed. It was never a possibility. Mm-hmm. But a lot of guys, I know when they went in R&R, they did whatever they wanted to do with whatever they wanted to do it with, and mm-hmm. because they. They came back and more than one would say, "Well, I can die happy now," or something. You know, I mean, it was sort of black humor, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I think the time I spent as a grunt, I thoroughly enjoyed it. I didn't begrudge a second of it. I'm glad I did it. I know some of my friends that stayed in the headquarters companies thought that I was nuts to want to make an issue to become a platoon leader, but. I wouldn't have traded that year for anything. I really liked it. And, of course, I took my flight physical. And of course, that brings one last story up before. I got on this Caribou, and I landed at Tansanute. Mm-hmm. And I'm right out of the field. And this was one of the longer trips we're on, so I'm grungy. Mm-hmm. I've got I have 60-millimeter mortars on my backboard. I've got smoke grenades and hand grenades hanging on me, and I smell really bad. And they dump me off in Tansanute, and I'm standing here. I haven't the faintest idea where I'm going, except that I'm supposed to find this medical detachment there who's going to take me to the hospital. And while I'm standing there looking around, these two colonels walk by me in their Saigon outfits, and look at me. And one said, "Lieutenant, do you always come to Saigon looking like that?" And I looked at him. Well, that's because I said, "Sir, I just came out of the field." And that was, and they walked on mumbling to each other. But I went and took my flight physical, and then the next day I was thrown back on a Caribou and taken back out to the unit. And when we got back in, I heard that the flight physical was satisfactory, and that was it. So when I came back from Vietnam, my ROTC commitment was over with. Mm-hmm. So I had orders to get out, and I had orders to Rotary Wing School. And I had spent, you know, my time there getting out of helicopters. I didn't like anything that helicopters did. I didn't want to do it myself. And so I ended up telling the Infinity Branch, hey, look, here's your choice. I'm getting out or I'm going to Fixed Wing School. And they sent me to Fixed Wing School. And okay. I stopped at Fort Riley to see my wife long enough to father my son, I suppose. That's what she says anyway. And then I went off to Fort Stewart, Georgia, and for the first half of flight school. I was assigned to Fort Benning from Fort Riley. So as soon as I could get Lizzie moved down, I got her moved down to Fort Benning with the trailer moved, and so I would. All through flight school, the first 6 months was at Fort Stewart, the last was at Fort Rucker. Mm-hmm. I'd drive home every weekend I could to see Lizzie and Annie, our daughter, who at that time thought that Daddy meant a helicopter. That's what Lizzie would do, is take her outside and point up at a helicopter and fly over and say Daddy. And so, as far as Annie was concerned, Daddy was meant helicopter. Mm-hmm. Went through fixed wing school, was at Fort Benning as an operations officer, training officer for a third aviation group, which was basically a training unit that the job at that time was to pick up brand new Chinook helicopters from Boeing, bring them down to Fort Benning, and then train whole company units at one time, maintenance and everything, on the Chinook, and then they would take their Chinooks and fly them to Sharp Army Depot in California, and they'd go on and take their unit to Vietnam, and the whole unit would go together. And I did that for a while, and then I got orders in right before Jamie was born. I got orders in sending me to Rotary Wing Qualification Course and back to Vietnam to a helicopter unit, and so second tour, I called up Branch and said, look, my son's going to be born, and the rules are that I have you, because second tour I can stay for my child to be born. So they said, okay, we canceled the orders, and so it's like they were in the delivery room with my wife. I wasn't. I was sent home as I was the first time, but. Mm-hmm. Within a week of my son being born, I get virtually identical orders. The unit changed, but everything else was the same. It was a Rotary Wing School into Vietnam and to a Huey unit, mm-hmm. which I wanted nothing to do with. So I called Branch up again. I said, look, guys, I really don't want to go to fly helicopters. And I said, I did it, and I think you can help me out here. I'm second tour, you know. And at that time, there were very few second tour people. Mm-hmm. They said, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, at that time, the brand new plane was a U-21. I said, I like to fly a U-21. So we both got a good yuckle at that, right? Ha, 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 ha. And I said, he said, what do you really want to do? I said, I don't care. I don't want to fly helicopters. I said, I'll fly bird dogs. He said, you'll fly bird dogs? I said, I'll fly bird dogs. He said, okay, consider those orders canceled. We'll cut new orders for you. And you'll be flying bird dogs. So fine. I was looking forward to that. That would have been fun. And it was fun. I know a lot of guys. Well, you met most of those guys there. They both those guys flew bird dogs in Vietnam.
Right.
And the good stories come out of there.
Right. Now, before we get into that, I need to ask a few questions about your first tour.
Sure.
I want to take one step back a little bit to the recon platoon that you came across.
Yep.
That got hit.
Yep.
And when you came upon them, I was wondering, had the Vietnamese unit that killed them, did they... had they processed them in any way?
No.
Had they taken their uniforms and their weapons, or did they just leave them like they had killed them?
There was a couple of weapons missing, but other than that, they just left them. But we were coming up on it when that happened.
Oh, so you were very close.
Actually, they were still shooting. We could still hear shooting, and we were there within 30 minutes of the shooting stopping. And so we were fairly close, and it was absolutely, and there was nobody alive. I mean, they were all dead. There was no nobody twitching. There was nothing.
Yeah.
It was that was it.
Okay.
And so we secured the perimeter. We called back in, and of course that was probably the worst thing that happened to the battalion,
mm-hmm.
probably to. to the brigade, so it was a big deal.
Yeah.
So we were very quickly relieved, and when we left, there was another unit was in there, and they were had come out with jeeps and an APC, and we hoofed it on back, and they brought the bodies in, and we had a ceremony then. It was, and they shipped them out at that point in time.
Okay.
But they hadn't at all.
Okay.
They were just there, and they were, mm-hmm. it was just the minute you got there, you saw what happened. There were two or three of the guys that were not in that trench, but there was enough. We found at least four sites where they had been shooting from. So it was, they were pretty much, they walked right into a classic ambush.
Yeah. Now, what was the most important lesson, or what were the most important lessons you learned during your first tour that you took away from that?
Oh, dear, these philosophical stuff. This is not laughing and telling lies, you know?
Not philosophical,
yeah.
Necessarily, but practical,
yeah.
things that suit you well.
I suppose the lesson I learned was that you could do things that most people found wouldn't do, and that in everything you found you could find some humor and some fun, and that's pretty much what I carried back from that. Was that I always look for the humor in a situation. That's probably, for me, that's what I came out of it with. And I've carried it to this day. I mean, you probably saw that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably the most important thing. And certainly it was the first time in my life where I, other than, let's say, playing football, where you trusted somebody in the real world. Football is not the real world.
Mm-hmm.
Don't tell that to anybody at Texas Tech now.
Okay.
Where you actually trusted somebody to do their job and expected and didn't worry about it getting done, and were disappointed when it wasn't done right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably. I mean, but really, I think probably the humor part of it was what I carried away from it.
And what was the most difficult thing about being a platoon leader, an infantry platoon leader in Vietnam?
I didn't find it at all difficult. I think probably what. You've got to get the guys to. I suppose you have to get the guys to trust you that you're not going to do something stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most of the other guys in the other platoons wanted to come to my platoon because they thought the chances were better. But I didn't find anything hard about it. I mean, I found things I didn't like to do, but I didn't find anything hard. I guess I probably can't answer that question at all well. I'll think about it as we're talking.
Yeah, okay. All right, so when you came back to the United States to go on to flight school, what kind of reception did you receive when you first landed in the United States and got off the plane, and then where did you come in through, and was there anything going on?
I came in through San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing going on.
Mm-hmm.
This was 1966, so it really hadn't even, the worst of it hadn't started yet.
Right.
I just simply, was in uniform. I was processed through, I forget what I was processed through. They found some of my contraband, but not all of it. I got my crossbow back and a few things like that.
I was just going to say, what did you get through?
My slingshot. They did get my AK-47, but for the most part, I was that was it. But the
did you get in trouble for that?
No. No, they simply took it.
Okay.
It was they knew it was there. They probably found it in Vietnam, and they didn't want to hold up the line of getting out of there. So they knew it was there, and they just said we need to take any weapons you happen to have. And there was nothing said at all about it. It was just straightforward.
Okay.
No, I mean, I just went from there. I went straight away to the airport and got a standby ticket home. Okay. That was it. I mean, it was really, really strange. You simply got off the, through the processing center. Mm-hmm. I forget where that was, actually. I mean, I don't know, we came in, how did I come back? I think I came back civilian, charter.
Okay.
Went over at 1:30. I think I came back civilian charter. And I don't know where, I don't remember where we, I know it was San Francisco, and we went through a processing center, and, that was basically it. They checked your, some guy gave you an eyeball, and that was all.
Mm-hmm.
And you were off, and you were home. Cheap airfare, or military standby, and you went home.
Okay.
Don't recall anything. In fact, I personally, in all of my time, never had an unpleasant experience from a civilian.
Hmm.
I had some times that I thought it was going to happen. I can remember one time I was walking in New York City in uniform, and I realized that there was a car was sort of trailing behind me on the street, and I got to a corner. This was Lower Manhattan, and I got to a corner, and the car turned partially across the corner, and two guys got out, and I really thought, oh, shit. And they wanted to thank me. But I never really, I mean, I got my first job in insurance because I was in Vietnam. I mean, I really personally never ran across, I've run into more interesting experiences since in the last 10 years than I have ever before then. I really never had any bad experience at all.
Okay.
It's basically, it was just like coming back from any place and just going home with your suitcase. Mm-hmm. You know, that's all it was.
You didn't have any hard time adjusting going from Vietnam back to your family?
I didn't think I did. Now, you should ask my wife that question.
Well, that's a good point. What did your wife think about you going in the first place?
She's a relatively stoic person.
Okay.
I don't remember. She was, of course, worried.
Yeah.
There was, of course, at that point in time, it was the first division. She stayed with the other wives. My aunt came out and stayed with her while I was gone. It was a fairly she had a lot of support going on, and other wives. We the trailer park that we were in was a pretty mixed group, and Liz had friends there. So overall, I think it was there was a good deal of support going on. Now, what she really was going through, I don't know. I could tell you that when I married my wife, she was a relatively dependent type person, and when I came back from Vietnam the first time, there was nothing she couldn't cope with.
Okay.
I mean, it was really. She just looked after herself. So I don't know. I think the worst transition we had was once I got out of the Army. That was very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I think probably everybody in her family and myself included didn't think that we were going to stay together. But we managed to work it out.
Wow.
But that was, keeping in mind that if you look at my time in the Army, if you go from November of 65,
mm-hmm.
64, November 64, I go 3 or 4 months to Fort Benning, Fort Riley, then I'm straight away off to San Diego, back for a couple of months, Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
back, 6 months at Fort Stewart, 6 months at Fort Rucker, a couple of months we have together at Fort Benning, Fort Campbell, where I'm forming a unit to take to Vietnam, so I'm just gone all the time. she goes home. I go back to Vietnam for a year, mm-hmm. come back to Lakehurst Naval Air Station. I already own the house now that I live in right now, mm-hmm. so Liz is living there, and for 3 years at Lakehurst with a thing in the middle there where I went back to Vietnam, I'm going home on weekends when I can get home on weekends. So I'm in the Army for almost 8 years. We probably didn't spend a grand total of 7 months living as a normal life. Okay. And that's making the assumption that living as an Army wife is anything remotely normal to start with.
Yeah.
Okay, so certainly that's why I say clearly I didn't have to deal with any transition really.
Yeah.
Everything was new and was happening. It was gone and back, and you were just sort of, I mean, it was like it really wasn't the first time I had to deal with any transition. Really, myself
mm-hmm.
was when I got out of the Army.
Okay.
So that was sort of a unique thing. Anyway, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, that was it.
All right, well, why don't you go ahead and I guess talk about? I'm sorry.
I didn't realize it was that long.
Oh. Yeah, time flies.
You know, this is the first time I've ever talked like this about Vietnam.
Okay.
It really is. Anyway, so I go to flight school, and I go back to Fort Benning shortly, and then I get a U-21 transition, which I am flabbergasted. I mean, my son is born at Fort Benning.
Mm-hmm.
I get my new orders in now where I'm supposed to be assigned strictly to fly bird dogs. And the orders come in, and I'm sent off to learn how to fly the U-21, and then I am assigned to Fort Campbell, mm-hmm. where I'm going to form a U-21 unit. It was called CPAC, and I have no idea what CPAC stood for, but it was okay. Went up to Fort Campbell, and I was flying the U-21. Went out to Wichita, and we picked up our brand new U-21. Got a transition out there on that plane, and then I had a Beaver assigned to me, and I had a couple of fixed wing guys come in to fly that, and we had a Huey, and I had three, four guys that flew the Huey, and a very small unit, and then after we pretty much got our equipment in, we got a National Guard major got volunteered for active duty, and he came in from either Tennessee or Kentucky, and I forget what his name was, Stewart or something like that, and he came in and became the CO, and we sort of packed up everything and headed for flew our airplanes out to Sharp and loaded them on a aircraft carrier, and that was it. Went over by boat. Now, of course, having been to Vietnam once before, and we had, and this was a small unit, we had like three or four Connexes that were ours to fill up, and we had a huge account that we could spend at the company store. In theory, we were supposed to buy supplies for a year. Well, I knew that I could get anything we really needed in Vietnam, but things that we really wanted was going to take special deals. So we spent our money on room air conditioners and fans and screen and sticky acetate and rigid plastic and all kinds of paint and fasteners and all these things that I know that once we got to Vietnam, I could trade for somebody's mother if I wanted to. It was no problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
Get somebody's wife for a year for some of this stuff. And so we showed up in Vietnam. We were assigned to Long Thong, which was brand new being built at the time. That was just north of Benoit.
Mm-hmm.
And I went over by boat on that trip, and it was a great trip over. We flew on the we went over in a General George Pope, and it was my little unit and a whole bunch of hospital units and veterinarians and what have you. And I spent my 30 days going over there playing hearts with a bunch of dentists. It was a good 30 days over.
Mm-hmm.
Arrived in the Trang. Our airplane had not arrived yet. That went by aircraft carrier. Went up and we were assigned to up the Long Thong. So I knew that the unit was going to be DeRose adjusted. That was the new process. So I hot-footed it right down to Saigon because our ship was being put, our planes were being put together at the time, and we were going to have to pick them up in a couple of days. Hot-footed right down to Tansadu to see if I possibly knew anybody at all from before. And ran into somebody who I knew and who vaguely knew somebody else, but who that person really knew somebody. And I got introduced into the personnel system, and the U-21s were brand new, so the guy took care of me. So I knew that there was that they already were working on the unit, and they I said, look, I volunteer for DeRose adjustment because I was sort of annoyed that I was no longer the CO, and secondly, the mission we had was night courier mission, which was nothing I wanted to do, and so I got the so I went back up and I said, don't worry, things will be looked after. We went and got our planes, brought them up to Longtan, and because Longtan was we were living in a tent. And they were, and the engineers were building stuff. Well, our connex has arrived, so I went to see the engineers, and I said, okay, what's it going to take to get our hooch built right away? And the guy looks at us, and he laughs. I was a captain at the time, and this other captain sort of laughed at me. So he takes off, and I go see the old sergeant that's running. I said, Sergeant, I said, I got a fair amount of stuff here. What do you really want to change the building schedule? And he says, well, what do you got? I said, well, this is what I got. Well, his eyes got bigger and bigger and bigger. So for a couple of air conditioners and some screening and a few other odds and ends, we ended up getting our hooch built next. Mm-hmm. And then the orders came in, and I got DeRosed out as I had planned on. And I got assigned to, there was, at Longtan, there was the Command Airplane Company, was there. And, that was the, headquarters, flight detachment for MACV. However, they also had a special detachment down at Tansanu that flew basically for the headquarters of MACV. Mm-hmm. And my orders came in assigning me to that detachment. Which the Colonel Ferris was the CO, and he was madder than hell because that was a plum assignment. He wanted people, and I was the only company, when I got there, I was the only company grade officer. It was all old majors and crotchety old warrant officers. But they just got the U-21s in. I was qualified so I ended up being stationed in Saigon, and we had a house just off base, about 15 blocks. It was eight of us or six of us in the house. We had three houses actually. I ran this one house. It had guards and a couple of maids, and we didn't have to stay in the. In the BOQ, we could have our own facilities, which was sort of a unique thing, and ended up flying for that detachment. Just after I got there, they were rotating a lot of people out, and I got interviewed and was approved as one of the four or five pilots that flew the commanding general, and I flew for. Flew Westmoreland. Westmoreland was just going at that time. He was gone within a month of me arriving, mm-hmm. and then flew Abrams for the when he flew him about half the time he flew. I flew him. Yeah. And
what did you think about Westmoreland?
I didn't like him. I disliked the man intensely. He was arrogant. He was demeaning. He treated people relatively poorly. By that time I felt I was sort of blaming him for most of the problems about the military side of it. It really wasn't his fault, but for the most part, though, my personal experience with him was that he was a difficult person, and I'm glad that he wasn't around there for long. Abrams, on the other hand, was exactly the opposite. In fact, I truly liked the gentleman. And if I could have had the two of them switch places, I would right now, with no question about it. You know, Abrams was a very nice, he frequently drove his own Jeep when he came out to the airplane. Had smoked his little cigars. He had, smaller cigars. He was pleasant to people. He was always in control, but always pleasant. I think most of the people around him genuinely liked the guy. Everything I had to do with the guy was great. And I saw him in action. We flew him enough that he was, you got to see him working with different people in the airplane and things like that. And he was a first class person all the way. In fact, I have on my wall, my office right now, an autographed picture of him that he gave me when I left Vietnam. Mm-hmm. He did that for all of the people that flew him. But mm-hmm. I mean, but I really liked the guy. He was nice.
Now, just out of curiosity, what did you think about the strategies, and did you see any changes? And in particular, you know, when you were platoon leader, before you went to Vietnam, you went through that phase of being the aggressor platoon leader.
Yep.
And then you got to Vietnam, and you saw the types of tactics that infantry platoons were employing in companies and battalions. And so what did you think about the tactics compared to what your training was? And then did your opinion of tactics, and did you think it was appropriate over time?
Well, certainly the tactics that the Army was applying, the Marines, the Americans were using, all it did was guaranteed that particular square foot of ground you were standing on at that moment was secure. Maybe not even guaranteeing that, but at least there was no Viet Cong on it with you. Essentially, I could not see where the tactics that they were using could achieve the goal that they were looking to achieve, which was democracy. Because by that time, by the time I was back over there, and let's say we're talking 68, okay, let's see, 66, 67, we're talking 68, 68, 69. Of course, things have changed dramatically. Yet I'm saying at that point in time, the country had not been totally destroyed. Saigon had changed dramatically, but flying around and flying the people that we flew, which was basically the brass and entertainers and things like that, countrywide, you got to see a lot of the country, and it was obvious I think the feeling was, and again, I may be applying some retrospect here, not speaking what I thought at the time. I think the assumption was that now it had moved into a more conventional type with the North Vietnamese regulars and all that stuff. But when I got back over there, it was just after Tet, so you can time that. I personally missed Tet by a month or something. So by the time I got back there, because all shit had broken free at that point in time, and things were swinging dramatically. But I basically felt, as an infantry person, that knowing the restrictions that we had when I left as a grunt, and then going back over and seeing it, that there was a little, if any, chance that the way they were going about it was going to reach the goal. And certainly the Hearts and Mind crap was exactly that. There was no real attempt to win the hearts and mind of anybody, and that was probably the saddest thing about it.
Do you think if a more concerted effort was made to actually win the hearts and minds, that would have been effective?
I think Vietnam has, and greeting of many, you have to look hard to find where anybody's learned any lessons from Vietnam. But I mean, if you go forward into the way several conflicts since then have been handled, where I think that, that Vietnam basically brought home the truism that there is no military solution to a political problem. Whatever solution there is to it is going to be temporary if it's imposed by winning a war or winning something. I think that's probably the truth that's come out of Vietnam. And we look at any of the conflicts that have been handled since. I think that's the that's sort of the underlying concern, fears, values, or you want to put it. Now, do I think that they've applied things correctly over the years? I think not. I think it's still too politicized. But mm-hmm. But I think that's probably it mm-hmm. on the on what came out of that. But certainly I didn't see it. By the time I was flying over there. Mm-hmm. When I first went over there, I probably felt that by that time it was either at peak or damn near peak, mm-hmm. and at that point in time I probably felt in the beginning that the numbers would prevail, but by the time I left that year, it was obviously numbers were not the answer. That the restrictions that I knew of two 3 years before were identical. Mm-hmm. The military was basically not allowed to make military decisions the way they normally would. That in fact everything was pre-planned. Every event was pre-planned. And by that time, I think corruption was so widespread. I mean, we flew that General Zhu, DZU, around all the time. He was the head of the. Turns out the black money. He was maybe doing black markets. But that guy was wherever we went, you knew because he was sort of the head of the regional police forces. And wherever you went with him, within a month, there'd be an operation in that province. So give me a break. I mean, what brains does that take anybody? I mean, it's like having a guy that throws only two pitches, high fast and high low. You know, give mm-hmm. me a break. Mm-hmm. Everybody in the world knew what was going on, and so I think that was. I don't think much changed.
Well, would you talk about these types of issues with General Abrams?
No. There was nothing. Any conversation I had with General Abrams were purely pleasantries. And anything that he talked about in the airplane, I wouldn't particularly talk about. So it's, no way. I mean, our relationship was as it is today when I fly anybody. It was strictly that a truck driver, you know, and it was not that was not the forum. And I have if General Abrams had any misconceptions, it was never conveyed outside of his staff office. Mm-hmm. I can say that. Mm-hmm. He was always professional and straightforward. But that was not an option. I mean, I don't know what would happen if I'd even tried to bring it up with him. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was still back in the days. I mean, he was a 4-star and I was a captain. And that's and he may have called me Peter, but it was. It was in the airplane, but that mm-hmm. was basically it. Mm-hmm. It was no, but it was. But still, that tour was a great time, and certainly my previous tour there made my life much easier than this one because mm-hmm. because I knew the ropes.
Yeah,
and it was a good time.
Now, did you were in country before Johnson made his decision not to run for re-election? You missed Tet by about a month, so you must have gotten there just before.
Yeah.
He made that decision. What?
I'm trying to remember, and I have no recollection of that at all.
You don't remember when that was even mentioned?
No, I really don't.
Okay.
I was pretty pro-military. I mean, I'll say. I mean, I was in the Army, and in fact, I was actually one to stay in, and would have stayed in probably. I had two problems. The Army didn't want me to stay in, and after Vietnam, they didn't want anybody to stay in, and. My wife didn't either, so it was, but it was, I was still pretty pro-military, and probably I would have been at that time. I probably would have felt betrayed or something. But it was obvious. I think that it was going the wrong way,
mm-hmm.
and numbers were not the solution. You know, it was not going to happen.
Now, by numbers, do you mean
people?
The attrition policy, the attrition strategy, the body count.
Yeah, that just wasn't going to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because first of all, by that time, I mentioned earlier that mm-hmm. the average Vietnamese person just wanted to be left alone,
mm-hmm.
By anybody, by everybody.
Yeah.
Certainly, while I was back over there, the second tier of flying, the U-21s. The issue then was that they really wanted people to go away.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had the two maids we had were two sisters, and they both had husbands in the Vietnamese Army. One was a officer, the other one was a enlisted guy, and they spoke reasonably good English, and I talked with them a bit, and they really, at that point in time, they felt that there was hope,
mm-hmm.
And I often wondered what happened after I left, because they felt that that for the most part, I was told by them that the average Vietnamese wanted to be free, did not want the communists to take over,
mm-hmm.
but that they were worried about their, the government people, and that wasn't, it was too much corruption. And I think the people, the peasants, certainly wanted everybody to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And if the reason the Vietnamese were there was because of the Americans, and they wanted the Americans to go as quickly as possible. But for the most part, they were not involved. They were not involved. They were just pure innocent civilians.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that most of the people, conversations. I don't ever remember having a serious. Even when I was back there in 71, did I ever recall having a conversation with anybody, drunk or otherwise, about should we be in Vietnam? Was or hearing anybody say that it was they may have expressed their opinion they wanted to get the hell out of there, but I don't ever remember being involved in a debate with one or more other people about the involvement or leaving or anything else. I really think that most people, most of the GIs in Vietnam, were there to look after themselves for a year and get the hell out. And most of them were, for every grunt there was 10 that never got near a gun. I don't know if that's the right ratio, but a hell of a huge ratio. And most of those guys, I can remember, the only other time I ever talked at all about Vietnam was a few years back when they were having their latest revival, not the one that's going on now, but the last one. And they had a little talk show on local cable, and they asked me if I would sit on it, and I said virtually nothing on it. But there was the guy that was actually getting it cranked up was a Marine, and I listened to him talk for the. And it's a good thing I didn't find this out while the show was going on, because I couldn't have kept my mouth shut. I'm a relatively blunt person. And I thought after doing our little half hour little show that this guy had been on the big Marine things up by Da Nang, and had seen guys blown away and carried out hundreds of bodies and everything else. Well, hell, he'd never even carried a gun in Vietnam. He was in supply or something.
Yeah.
And after, when he tells me this thing, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I'm sure my mouth just flapped. And this is the kind of guy. He's back now, and he's claiming all sorts of horrible psychological problems and everything else. And I don't understand it. And I will be honest, I have absolutely no sympathy for people like that.
Mm-hmm.
I made one trip to a Vietnam veterans thing about, and I was, you know, and I thought, okay, somebody called me up and asked me if I'd please come. I said I would. Well, it was essentially what it was a bunch of guys looking to find some way to get something for nothing out of the government. They had some entitlement because they'd been in Vietnam, and that they're owed something for this thing. I have very, very little compassion, I guess, for that sort of approach to anything.
Mm-hmm.
But I can say I don't ever remember. Even lately, I have my wife's cousin married a guy who likes to debate stuff and takes great pleasure in playing the devil's advocate. And the only conversation I've really had about the pros and cons of Vietnam was with him, mm-hmm. and he's basically a very sympathetic person about that. So it's, but I don't ever recall. I don't ever remember sitting in a joint or a bar or the stateside or anything, talking about it. And of course, in the guard, the guys that are still in the guard that were in Vietnam, there's not many of us left. We mostly laugh and tell lies.
Mm-hmm.
We remember. I mean, we all of us can think of. I mean, the things like throwing EM-80s into the shit can for somebody in the toilet, that sort of
mm-hmm.
stuff. You know, it's or plastic, or, you know, these rubber snakes you'd buy,
mm-hmm.
and I mean all the funny things that you did, the jokes you did, and the X-rated movies on the cable that you plugged in, and some guy would say it was AF, you know, the AF TV station, your R&Rs and you're fooling around and the picnic trips flying. I mean the things that we did. It's you sort of remember those things, and certainly the by the time I left Vietnam flying, it was obvious that the wind was changing dramatically,
mm-hmm.
And at that, but still I can say too at that point I don't recall any problems in as being a grunt with any of my men. There was never a discipline problem. There was never people saying. Refusing to do anything, there were always the odd guy who tried to get out of it, with limping around or saying he had a cold or something. But for the most part, there was no hostilities, and excuse me, and my relationship with my men was always cordial. I honestly believe that we were friends, and I think they all understood that I did whatever I could to see that they stayed alive,
mm-hmm.
And I think that I never had a problem with that. Even when I was flying U-21 in Vietnam out of Saigon, it was those kind of things were few, where you rarely heard about. They were not openly discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the last time I was in Vietnam, where there was actually sometimes open hostility between the enlisted and the officers. You mm-hmm. saw in some of the places you went into.
Okay.
And
before we talk about that, I'm going to have to change CDs. This is about to run out.
Okay.
So let me end CD 1 of the interview with Mr. Peter Faber.
Okay.
This is CD number 2 of the interview with Mr. Peter Faber. Okay, with your second tour.
Yep.
Did you fly? You mentioned flying both General Westmoreland and General Abrams.
Yep.
Did you fly other commanding officers or other celebrities or?
Flew all kinds of people. Flew Marcos once when he was president of the Philippines. A lot of generals, entertainers, congressmen, senators. Most of those guys, when they found anyone from their state, they didn't want to talk to you. funny, you have some some people you remember. Like for example, I flew Jimmy Stewart.
Did you really?
And his wife around. Now, You would think at that time he was a brigadier general in the California Air National Guard, right, or reserves or something. He was a pilot. Probably, he left me with such a horrible taste in my mouth that to this day I can't even watch him in any of his cute movies.
Really?
The only thing sad about it, he was inconsiderate, and he had treated us like dirt.
Wow.
And the only mitigating factor at all was that his son was a Marine, and he's up in Pleiku, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Or he was an officer anyway. We flew him. We had to be, it could have been Pleiku. It had to be way Fubai or someplace like that because we had to stop in Da Nang for gas. And we flew him in air to see his son. And then we were on the way back, and we were with him a couple, 3 days. He was doing a tour around Vietnam, and and shortly after he left Vietnam, his son was killed. So that was that was the minute. But he was really everybody we had that we flew. Generally, you're either leaving them and coming back, but if you were waiting return, you know, or stayed with them, then they were, arrangements were always made to make sure that number one we had security, and number two that we knew everything and when what times were and what have you. And he thought nothing about keeping us waiting for hours. He made no provisions, and the people with him made no provisions for us. Well, we would, for example, we were told what mission was, and it would be changed arbitrarily, which was their authority.
Mm-hmm.
But it would mean that we were going to be no place where we could get lunch or anything. Well, I mean, it got so we started carrying food with us because we knew that whatever was going to happen, we were going to be screwed. On the way back, because he had deviated, we didn't have enough fuel to get back to Saigon, so we had to stop at Da Nang for fuel. And he was a pilot, and he knows that the mission has been changed. He's got to have done it himself. I mean, what the hell? And so I tell him we're flying. I'm saying, I go back. I say, sir, I'm sorry, but we deviated from our mission. We're going to have to stop and get fuel at Da Nang before we head down to Saigon. And so he was mad. And then once he got back, he tried to get us in trouble. I mean, so ever since then, I had no use for Jimmy Stewart. I mean, he really treated us like a sack of crap.
Hmm.
Yet, I mean, we flew Martha Ray a lot, and Joey Bishop and Sebastian Cabot, Gypsy Rose Lee. Funny story out of that was she gave us an autographed postcard, which I sent home.
Mm-hmm.
And Liz had it held up on the icebox with the with magnets, and our daughter came in to said and said, Mommy, come and look. And she drags into the room. She said, look, this lady's popping her magnets. And the thing had curled on the icebox, and the magnets were popping off on the floor. But and congressmen and senators and visiting generals, a lot of Filipino generals and Korean generals. Flew the Aussie guy one time when he came over. It was great duty. I mean, I was... scheduling officer. I tell you, fly this guy Zhu around. Nobody liked to fly the Vietnamese much because it was a problem. There was always something going on, and so here we got this new guy, this guy Zhu, and we're going to a rinky dink little airport up in the middle of nowhere, I can't think of the name of it. It's a coast town just north of the Trang, where they had the
Hoi An.
No. They did they made good nuke bomb there, not the best, which came from Phu Quoc. But anyway, whatever this little village, seaside village was, we landed at an airport about 6 or 7 miles inland from there.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, nobody wanted to go because it was going to be a Vietnamese wait and return.
Mm-hmm.
So we So I say, okay, I'll take the mission. So I sign myself on the mission. We land, and this guy gets out, and he takes off. And immediately, though, I see that we're totally surrounded by good guys. So I'm very happy about that, because this is not the greatest airport in the world. And this lieutenant comes over with a jeep, a Vietnamese, speaks great English, says, I'm here to show you around. And it could have been Quy Nhon, because I'm just trying to think.
Okay,
it, and so he said, we're secured the airplane for you. Lock it up, and then I'm going to show you around a bit, and then we're going to have lunch with the general. So off we go, and he takes us down. And that's the first, only time I've ever seen him making nuke bomb in these big, huge vats, fermenting all the garbage in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we come back, and we show up at the province state house, or the governor's house, wherever it was. And there's this big banquet table laid out, and myself and the guy I'm flying with have a table. We're sitting at the end of the table, there was probably 20 people at this big long conference table, and because everything was Oriental and we all had chopsticks,
mm-hmm.
but the food was wonderful, and there was plenty to drink, which we couldn't partake in, but it was really a hell of a good party,
mm-hmm.
and then we fly back to Saigon. As soon as that next time I saw him the name come in for a mission, I put my name on the flight. And I probably flew the guy half a dozen times. Second time, though, that I flew him, which was the next time he flew with us, when we got to the, because I knew we were going to get lunch, we got to the place for the lunch, and the two place settings for myself and my co-pilot had knife and fork on it, because the guy had seen it. We both struggled with chopstick. Of course, by then, I'd learned how to use chopstick, so I figured I'm not going to pass out on a good meal like that again. But it was good, but this guy was actually ended up being executed for black marketeering. But a lot of guys like that we flew, and they flew a lot of common people. Abram's wife was over in Saigon, so on major holidays we would fly him over.
Mm-hmm.
His son was a second lieutenant up in Pleiku, and I know he was up there. And we would on Christmas, Thanksgiving, he would get leave, or he would get some time off, and we'd fly him over to see his mommy.
Mm-hmm.
We actually made a second lieutenant star plate for him, and he thought it was funny.
Mm-hmm.
And we picked him up, and we forgot about it. We got back to Saigon, and the second lieutenant star plate was sitting in the window of the airplane, and my boss, who was the detachment commander, saw it and went absolutely ballistic.
Mm-hmm.
I think if Abrams had seen that, he would have laughed, because he knew. I mean, mm-hmm. he was a pretty straightforward guy like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the people. I mean, a lot of guys we flew around. I mean, I got a lot of pictures I took of these people. I wish I could find them. I have one of Martha Ray I did find, but it was we flew. She liked the Special Forces, so we would pick her up and fly her from Special Forces camp to Special Forces camp, and she was always and it was sort of she lived just like the Special Forces guys lived. So she'd get on the airplane And you could tell that she was using no bath to hide the lack of showers. It was sometimes it was really so it'd give you a headache.
Mm.
You'd fly with your window open. I remember one time we had really a rough day too. She really had to take a leak, and all we had was these little funnels that go through a Venturi tube, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she really had to go, and I was no way she was not going to use that tube. And it was rougher than hell. I mean, it was so bad that some guy stood there and held a blanket or something up, which he fell down two or three times, and finally she just told him to hell with it, and she took her leak in the fish tube, and that was it. But the I was one of the last, probably the last Army airplane out of Khe Sanh when they were shutting that thing down.
Mm-hmm.
They were after that they shut the airfield down, and then that's when they got beat up pretty bad and abandoned the place.
Mm-hmm.
I took one round over there. I was the only one that took a round. It was flying into a little coastal airport someplace, and I heard what I thought. I was carrying a couple of American colonels and some Vietnamese guys, and they were in their web gear, and they were loaded with everything. And I heard what sounded to me like a hand grenade pin being pulled. That
mm-hmm.
sort of that pop sound, a
mm-hmm.
pst like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked in the back, and we were just on short final, and I I looked in the back, and I see everybody's in two pig piles, one pig pile in the back of the airplane, one pig pile in the front of the airplane. And I figure for sure one of these dumb jerks had accidentally pulled a hand grenade and off their web gear, and it popped the thing. And mm-hmm. I'm sitting there. Well, I said, that's it. You know, what am I going to do? It didn't go off, of course. And as we touched down, and by this time one of the colonels had extracted himself, and a sniper had shot up at the airplane. He must have been laying right on the end of the runway because he shot straight up and went right through the belly, right between the legs of a Vietnamese, and right through his notebook and right through the brim of his hat and out the roof of the airplane. And, of course, everybody totally panicked in the airplane.
Yeah.
And so that was the only round our unit took in Vietnam. And now that one was taken. That was my last flight because the deal we had was we knew the people at Shell Oil Company, and they had this sort of this compound in Saigon with a swim pool. And we had a couple of rooms they gave us there that were right on the pool. And when you were rotating out, your last week or last 2 weeks, you didn't have to fly if you didn't want to. And you'd go spend 5 days at Shell. But if you look at my records, I had 988 hours of combat flight time. And I thought it'd be nice to get 1,000 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So I scheduled myself. I figured, that's only 12 hours. I can do that. If I pick the missions, I can fly 3 days, and at the end of it, I'll get my 1,000 hours. I go back to add 1,000 hours. So I have look at my records. I have 988 hours because that was my last mission. I flew in that, and I was scheduled to fly the next day, and I took that round. I landed. I said, guys, I'm taking my 2 weeks off. That's the end of that. I figured that's the only round the unit took in the whole year I was there, that it was, and it was me, that I wasn't going to be the second round that unit took. So that was the end of that.
How did you avoid getting shot at for a whole year?
Well, the mission we did was strictly, and we went into some pretty interesting place. We got shot at, but we never took a hit.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say, if you were flying over to Special Forces camps, you were flying over bad country.
Oh, yeah,
so,
but I'm talking about being hit.
Yeah. So you were fired at, but they were so pathetic.
I am sure that we were fired at a hell of a lot more than we thought we were.
Yeah.
I mean, we went into a lot of unsecured shit. Well, we flew this Admiral House around. Admiral House was the leader of the Riverines. He was the commander of Naval Special Operations in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget whether he was a uppercase or lowercase guy, but he was, there's no such thing as a one-star admiral. They're always, at least that's what I understand, they're always two-star, and it's uppercase, lowercase. A lowercase admiral is a one-star, but he wears two-stars. The uppercase guy is a real two-star. But this guy, we used to haul him out to these weird little ladderite strips out in the middle of the delta where the Riverines would have their bed. This guy was a big guy. I don't know how big. I'm sure he's grown 2 or 3, 4 or 5 inches in the years since I last saw him. But my recollection of a guy that was well over 6 feet, big-chested, narrow waist, and he carried a sidearm, which was a sawed-off shotgun. And he carried a little, like a little dispatch sack. And this guy, I can remember one time where the Jeep didn't show up for him at the airbase, at the airfield. So we're sitting there. I said, sir, why don't we just sort of take off and fly around a bit? He says, I'll see you when I'm supposed to pick him up in the afternoon. He says, I'll see you in the afternoon. And off he goes walking down the road. And in the afternoon, we picked him up. You know, that was it.
Hmm.
But we flew into a lot of weird little places. And I know of two times we were being shot. We were being mortared. At one time, we had mortars landing in this on the airfield when we were taking off. But that was sort of outside, on the perimeter, not exactly on the runway. But
mm-hmm.
I don't know. The mission we did was basically, you flew 9-5 up country, 10-5 down country, 9,500 mm-hmm. flying up and 10,500 flying down,
mm-hmm.
and you made your landings, and that was it. And mm-hmm. most of the airfields you were going into were secured, But you know, I can remember though. I have a picture of me someplace asleep on an airplane wing, with the feminine mystique on my chest. Now I'm sure that brings glad feelings to every feminist on the face of the earth. But that was a little laterite field where we spent the whole day there, just two of us, not a living soul around. I look back at that and think, oh, here I am sleeping and reading, and I had to be out of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the only guy that flew that carried weapons.
Mm.
Very few other people carry weapons. And I had a Swedish K and an M40 with a bunch of HE rounds and my issued sidearm. And I had the Walter PPK too. So when I was on that airplane, I had this little sack I carried. They put it on the back of the air. I mean, I was the only one that carried anything like that. And people used to make fun of me. Never had to use it,
mm-hmm.
but I think back on those things, and it was really strange. But it was really a good duty. We had the hours. We flew a lot, and flew weird hours, like you might have to get up at 4 in the morning. We had a driver and a jeep that would take the crew, so we always scheduled crews, early crews, so they came out of the same house. But I ran my house, and I got $35 a month from everybody, and that paid for three meals, open bar, and laundry, dry cleaning, cleaning, everything else, boot shine, brass shine, the whole nine yards. I did a lot of trading. I had friends at the Class 6 store, and I would get, I guess you could say I was always sort of a wheeler dealer, but it was, friends at the Class 6 store, and I'd go there and I'd use up, ration card on liquor, and I'd pay off our maids with, Johnny Walker Black and, bourbon. So what I paid $3 a bottle for, that would be good for a week of work.
Wow.
And they would probably get 130, $140 for a bottle of Johnny Walker Black off the black market. Which I knew that, but I figured that we had a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
While we were there, we had a baby born, and we had a good time, we had a little Honda scooter that we had for the house, and we'd go shopping. We'd go out of Cholon to the Navy Exchange for the stuff for the American type food. They had a commissary there, very nice commissary, and then the rest of the stuff came off the economy. If anybody went into Rockjaw from the house, you made sure they got big prawns. Flew into Dalat, you made sure you came back with a box of vegetables. Again, it was just by chance. I landed there, and this Dalat was where they had the military academy for
mm-hmm.
Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm standing, I land in with this general in the back, and he's climbing out, and I see this major come walking up, and I'm looking at the guy, and I'm saying, God, does he look familiar? And I look at his name tag, and it was a guy that was a fraternity brother of mine from Rhode Island.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I had only known him for my freshman year, and then he was a senior that year. So I hop off, and I say hi to him. His name was Thivo Menendez, and we chatted, and he's one of the advisors at the military academy, and he's also got something to do with the ration point where all the fresh vegetables were. So whenever we showed up there, we hopped down to the ration point, and they would see us coming, and they'd holler, okay, and they'd get one little Vietnamese guy, say, mix box, and he'd go running off to the bins, and we'd come back with a big whacked box full of fresh lettuce and stuff and throw it in the back of the airplane, plus my boat trip over with the veterinarians and the dentist. Most of the veterinarians were there for food inspectors.
Mm-hmm.
And one guy was a guy that actually lived just through the woods 200 yards from my house with a veterinarian and a local veterinary, and now he's back in Connecticut again. And so I'd go see him or one of his friends, and we'd go down to the docks with his official veterinary jeep, and he'd condemn a couple boxes of meat or something for veterinary inspection, food inspection, and that would be that. So we lived a pretty good life, and that was right up until as I left, they shut the houses down within a month of my leaving.
Why?
They were starting to have problems in the city. That's when the city was starting to break down a bit, really badly. This would be like '69, towards the middle of '69, and of course we were had the only deal. The only person that lived better than we did in Vietnam was Abrams. It was creating a problem, and really what the biggest problem was that we were a detachment from this outfit up in Long Thon, and those guys up there used to come down, and they got stuck in Saigon, they'd end up staying in one of the houses. They'd go back, and they'd raise all kinds of hell about how they live like crap, and we live so good, and why are we down there for a full year, and nobody rotates through it, so they finally, it was just falling apart then, but it was, I got the full year out of it. It was a good time. And after Vietnam, I came back and went to Lakehurst, Naval Air Station, which was the Army had a big aviation test facility there for electronics, and I was operations officer there and one of the project officers, which we had a bunch of civilian pilots that for continuity because the Army guys would come and go. So there was always, on every project, there was one civilian and two military pilots, or one, it was a short one, and you'd fly this avionics stuff. And I got involved with the inertial navigation system there, and flew all of the hours on that myself. There was, all the test flights. It was out of, I think it was Canadian Marconi or Canadian Litton was made this sucker, and it was, I'd say it was marginally reliable, but it was great new stuff. I mean, it would be like a computer almost. It was fancy. It was state of the art. The Army didn't do anything state of the art. So as it turns out, it was they were supposed to have a training of some people from Vietnam. This was going into the RU-21s under Laughing Eagle, but it was Laughing Eagle. I think it was a inertial system which would give you immediate lat long readout of where you were, sort of like the underachieving GPS system. It was GPS is a million times more reliable and more accurate, but this at the time was it. So as it turns out, there was whatever the problems were, the people that were supposed to be trained for this thing didn't show up or couldn't come. So I ended up getting a third tour to Vietnam with this thing. I went over as a new equipment training team, a one-man team, and flew over first class on Pan Am because this thing had to be chained to me and it had to have its own seat. That was a good trip over. And it was over there for about 5 or 6 months. Was going to be there longer, but by that time they were winding stuff down, and then they just called it off.
So this was 1971.
This was 71. It was while I was over there, the decision was the pull out date was decided on, and everything by that time was winding down. We shouldn't say winding. Winding down is not the right word. Collapsing was a better word, I suppose. Okay. But what I was doing was the first thing I did, I went to Long Thon, which was a big RU-21 headquarters there, and I trained all the SIPs, the standardization pilots on the system. And then what their job was going to be was to standardize the procedures. And then I went and trained all the IPs, and I flew all over the country training the IPs to train the pilots to use this thing.
And, these were all Americans?
All Americans, yeah. You know, it was all the RU-21s. There was basically four major bases in Vietnam for these things. It was the Long Thanh. There was Way Phu Bai. There was Da Nang, and there was Nha Trang. And those were where most of them were flew out of. And they basically were the guys that had all the weird radios. They were mostly listening posts, but a lot of them were doing IR and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I was back at Long Thanh for the setting up what was going to be the last 3 or 4 month training phase, where I gave the check rides to the IPs on the system, and the and I was sort of sitting in the club, and of course I mean there were guys who always give me a hard time because I was TDY and I'd been there for a fair amount of months, you know, and I got, you know, the guy came in and you know said the old man wants to see you, and I went to see him, and he said we're gonna call this thing off, we're just gonna keep the people trained that we have. And that's when I found out that that this was early, probably late summer, early fall of 71. And, of course, 72, the basic thing was over with. And I was out of the Army in 72. I came back to Vietnam, came back on a 141. And I went back and forth to Vietnam. I went over on a 130, came back on a civilian charter. Went over on a boat, came back on a military plane. I went over first class and civilian all the way, and then I came back. I don't know. It was military and civilian. It was every possible way you could go. I went back and forth to Vietnam, but it was. And I came back, and I was at that point in time. My wife had told me to get out or get out. And so I put in my paperwork to get out of the Army, and I got a phone call from this same Major Swift that I'd seen when I was my ROTC guy. He was a full colonel now, and I'd stayed with him on my first R&R in Vietnam. He was now either chief of infantry branch or number two guy, and we talked on the phone, and he told me that I should withdraw my resignation because he said, look, I'm going to tell you right now, voluntary indefinite company grade officer, which I was, reserve officer. I did not opt for RA. There would be none left in the infantry branch by the time they got done. So he said, I almost guarantee you that you'll be rifted, and if you're not, you can always get out then. So I got, on the last rift, they got me along with everybody else, the ones that were left. And that was April of 72, and I happy my birthday, April 25th of 72, and that day I signed out of Fort Monmouth, and drove up and signed into the National Guard. And I've been in the National Guard since that day to this day, basically flying fixed wing. The Army, the Guard finally got me to go to helicopter school, and I flew helicopters for a while in the Guard, which I didn't particularly like. I liked a lot of the Loach, but I didn't like the Huey at all. But now I'm back flying airplanes, and I'm, at this point in time, as far as I know, I'm the oldest guy flying in Connecticut. I think I'm the oldest guy flying in the Army, actually, active duty guy.
Okay. Now, what did what was the hardest thing about transitioning from the Army active duty to civilian/reserve or National Guard?
Actually, that was fairly straightforward. The unit I was in was probably well prepared me for the National Guard. It was totally loose because you had all these projects going. Everybody was doing their own thing, and the old man's attitude was you do your job, and they let the operational officer, which happened to be me at that time, control what was going on, and his attitude was just what mine was. If you embarrass me, you're dead meat. Mm-hmm. You get one strike and you're dead meat with him. And so I was sort of, the operation that we had at the Lakers was when we had all these civilian pilots flying for us military guys going, airplanes all over the country, projects going all over the country, guys going to Canada, guys going to Mexico, all doing these things, and it sort of was really more like managing a flight department of some airlines than was anything else. So when I got out of the Army and going into the Guard, the biggest transition was, because I was being in the Army, I was still rank conscious, okay? I was a captain.
Yeah.
And the biggest transition going into the Guard was the fact that rank became almost, it became only important if the guy you were talking to signed your OER.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only time it became important. But other than that, I think that that it was a very, very easy transition. Now, granted, you weren't in the, didn't go to the Guard every day.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly as I spent time in the Guard, I actually probably found myself more comfortable. I will tell you that in my opinion, at least in today's Army, back when I was in active duty, it wasn't quite the same, maintenance in the reserve facilities is superb. You have the same people there for years at a time,
mm-hmm.
which is not the same in the Guard. But I thought it was not, and of course at that point in time, this is probably the most interesting or probably the most important thing. The Guard was basically, the Army aviation part of the Guard was basically Vietnam guys. All these guys were coming back from Vietnam and they're in the Guard.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I joined the Guard, they didn't have its first Huey yet. They got their first Huey about a year after I was in the Guard.
Hmm.
So it was, I mean, they were flying 23s, 23s and 13s, and I was flying a Beaver and a Bird Dog,
okay.
Some H-34s. So we had old stuff,
mm-hmm.
and so all Vietnam guys, and while I was fixed wing only, one of the rare fixed wing only guys, most of these guys had new people in common, had been in the same area, it was really. Drill was a time you look forward to, and I would say probably in retrospect it was wonderful therapy for all of us.
Hmm.
It was that weekend a month where you went off and you had guys that you had an extremely strong thing in common,
mm-hmm.
Vietnam's time by flying. So you've got, first of all, you had the camaraderie that pilots always have with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had this Vietnam thing. So really you got there and I tell you, I felt sort of sorry, about 10 years ago it started to change, but up to about 10 years ago, I felt sorry for the non-Vietnam pilots that came into the Guard, because they really were not treated particularly well, because they had low time, they weren't competent, their war story was what happened to them down at some joint in Panama City, and they were of course younger than we were, and it really was I felt sorry for those guys. They had a worse transition than we had, because it was I thought the guard thing was great. For me, the Guard was turned out to be ideal, because not only was it a great probably therapy for us, where you really laughed and told lies and worked, well, probably in the whole process was working things out yourself.
Yeah.
You also had for me, it was a great escape from my civilian job, which at times got extremely stressful,
mm-hmm.
because flying was something where I'm totally relaxed at doing it, but you're focused.
Mm-hmm.
So thoughts don't really intrude into your process. You think about what you're flying, but you're not working at doing it, so you're relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that for me, and there's a number of guys that I've talked to that have felt the same thing. They felt that the Guard was a great deal for them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it can really work out a lot of things. You have a bunch of guys sitting around that maybe did the same thing but different places, and you talk, and if they're having problems, and it's amazing, you look at them, and there's not a whole lot of divorces
hmm.
in this group.
Mm-hmm.
Um, I don't know anybody that's truly screwed up in the group, no more than I am, I suppose. But I mean, it's it was really you know, maybe just a group that stayed on. I mean, those, you know, I mean, that's a very small percentage for sure. Most of them just walk away. Once they're out, they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've met guys now that I look at and I find out they actually, you know, I mean, they flew helicopters in Vietnam, and they, and all their flying, their total flying and only flying experience is the flight school and a trip to Vietnam and out of the guard. I mean, out of the army. That's
mm-hmm.
it. And these guys are ones that like flying. Now, I did it because I like flying. And I had no job.
Mm-hmm.
But that's long since stopped being. I do it now because in fact, I'm losing money. Past 60, I can retire, collect my retirement check at age 60. I make more money on my retirement check than I do out of my guard check. But to me, I told my wife it's cheaper than owning an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a less chance of killing myself flying with the guard.
Mm-hmm.
But it's it was not a hard transition at all. The harder transition was once I moved home.
Okay.
And I'm after 8 years or 7.5 years in the Army and not living together really at all,
mm-hmm.
Or being separated for long periods of time, we were different, vastly different people.
Mm-hmm.
And it took us a long time, probably a couple, 3 years, for us to really work things out, where it became obvious that the children helped a lot in how things worked out.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they were supportive or anything else, just that they were there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that I changed dramatically. I mean, I look back and I see people that I'm still friends with from, let's say, college, and they say I haven't changed a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly I don't think they remember. I think, I mean, most of these guys I still see from college are guys that I saw off and on whenever I was home too.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't see. I'm sure that I know that you have to have changed, particularly when you're doing something like that and then thrown back in the civilian world. And so we managed to solve our whatever issues we had, and it worked it out pretty good. The children probably were the worst part, because they really didn't know me at all, and I missed them. Strangely enough, they were both about 6 months old when I went to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
And so I missed that year when they went from being little cauliflowers to being human beings,
mm-hmm.
On both of them, and then certainly I was never there. I mean, I was. You know, I'd be home for a weekend,
mm-hmm.
and that would be it. I mean, I'd leave, I would be home, and that would be, you know, for 30 days or 2 weeks or something like that. So I felt that's probably the thing I feel the sorriest about. And I think we've sort of worked it out, our kids. I mean, myself and it took myself and my son a long time to work things out.
Mm-hmm.
But because I saw too much of him and me. I mean, of me and him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he went down the same path I did, and I know that when I was at that age, I would get options. But at this time, when he was dicking around between schools, I knew that second and third options were becoming harder and harder to find.
Mm-hmm.
With me, as long as I could play football, I could find some place to go to school. But the I don't know. I look back over the whole Vietnam thing. I never regretted a thing. I enjoyed it. The thing about Vietnam, this is a little different from people that I know. I made no friends but one out of Vietnam, out of going to Vietnam.
Hmm.
I never maintained contact with any of my my platoon sergeants or any of the guys. I did go back to saw the one kid that I quite liked that had his foot blown off by a landmine.
Mm.
When I was, and he lived outside of Augusta, Georgia. I did go and try and find him. I found his mother and father, but I never was able to. He was never available to see me, so
mm-hmm.
I never got to see him.
Mm-hmm.
But I did make one friend out of Vietnam flying, who I still see occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
He's out in Kansas City,
mm-hmm.
and that's basically it. And I don't know whether that's normal or not.
Mm-hmm.
The friends that I've got are from flight school.
I mean,
these guys. Except for Ted Bitigeri, who I spoke to off and on over the years. It wasn't until Dave Fahrenbach and Gary got cranked on the sucker in Al Spain
mm-hmm.
that it came together, and those have been three great weekends.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's it. You asked a question before what I thought about the procedures of the military operation and what it was doing.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of crossed my mind a couple of times in this conversation. I just think that the when the government went in there, I don't think they probably had a clear idea of what they were. What they were getting into. I suspect that to some extent the whole process was affected by people having various takes on things to further their own goals and desires. I'm sure that the military was looking for a place to have some action.
Mm-hmm.
They had their motives.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that the elected officials had their goals, their needs for things. A lot of it was, statistics don't lie, but liars use statistics. You know, it's you can prove anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think the whole thing was just sort of everybody was orchestrating it for their own needs, and the early part of it, it happened to be all the needs sort of had you going in the same general direction. And it wasn't until that the needs started to change that this thing started to unravel. And the military was making up their rationalizations to solve their problems, to live with their problems, as was the politicians. And then I just think it was one of those flypaper things where you get stuck on it, and there's it hurts like hell to pull the fly off the paper, right?
Mm-hmm.
Leave a couple legs behind. So it's but from the beginning, from the time I was there in 65,
mm-hmm.
The military was never truly allowed to control the operation,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's probably the what really it just allowed, and because and nobody really wanted to admit that, so you had the things like the artificial body counts and these reports that were used to justify things and all the crap that goes on
mm-hmm.
to make things look better than they are or to prove a point or influence a decision or something, which may or may not be exact truth.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you know, I say that, and I truly I had good times, and I'm glad that I did it. I'm extremely satisfied with myself about that whole process. And I hope this helps you some. I don't know.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, what do you think are the most important lessons that we should take away from the Vietnam War experience?
You mean as a people?
As a nation.
Well, I have two fears. First of all, the first fear is that Vietnam has become something that it's become a swear word. You know, they talk about the Russians Vietnam. They talk about the all this sort of stuff. I think my biggest fear is that Vietnam legacy makes decisions not decisions that should be made. Example is what happened in the Slavic states when that thing was falling apart. I am convinced that fear of another Vietnam, whatever you want to say, prevented the proper and timely use of the military force that probably would have saved this whole, at least a lot of this ethnic crap that went on all over there. That's my large, you can see it. I mean, I get extremely frustrated when I listen to these politicians use Vietnam to rationalize the decisions that they're making that are obvious. You know that the guy with a briefcase ain't going to solve the problem. The other thing about Vietnam that I fear has happened is that the Vietnam experience has allowed the military, all the military services, to be so demonized that the people that you should be having in the military are not going in the military. Those two things are my worst fears. I mean, and these are things that I actually think have happened, and I don't know how they're going to, they should be stopped. But on the, on the other question, the biggest things we carried, the lessons learned, I suppose, is that I think you need to have a line drawn between the military and the government. I think you should I think the government, the civilians need to give if they're the ones that decide the goal, to decide the goal, but then don't micromanage the people with the training to do the job. And the other thing that we have learned from that is that, and it's being used by everybody today, is the impact, right or wrong, that media coverage has on the events, and how now, just think of the Gulf War, for example, and how that was media managed. Think of how almost everything now that happens is media managed. You've got your spin doctors and everything. I mean, it's absolutely amazing, and that's the other thing that we carried away from it. I mean, it's
And that's a good thing, you think? To go ahead and manage the media, don't give them full rein.
It's not so much the full rein. I don't think it's a good thing. I think the fact is that to manage appearances means making decisions that may not be the exact right one to make. And you can't get rid of the media. I don't really blame the media for what happened. They were simply taking the pictures, and when you've got a very few people doing something, and there's people that don't want to go, and they're verbal and they're organized, then you've got a situation where this information flow, the pictures and the stories and the cameras and everything all the videos that were taken were ideal, and they showed in graphic detail the horrors, even though you could go to any street corner and take the same picture practically in the bigger cities. It's still there. And then when you think of the number of people that went through Vietnam, and you think of the number of people that were actually killed, and the fact that the vast majority of those were probably killed in accidents, really.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the millions of men and women who went through there, mm-hmm. there were 50,000 is a very, very small percentage.
Yeah.
And it was like every one of those 50,000, that's all you saw. I think the lives of the survivors are probably more important mm-hmm. to look at than the lives of those that really died.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnam made an honorable, and I'll say honorable death, because I think basically most of them were,
mm-hmm.
A public rather than a private occurrence. And I think that the circumstances surrounding death should be public knowledge, but the actual death is private. It's a person and his family,
mm-hmm.
and that was taken away from families, and it was used. Tragedies were used on a grand scale to not mold public opinion, because I don't believe that the average, just like the debate now over abortion, it's just not the same. You're not talking about a majority or a vast or otherwise. It should be. They took that away, and they used it to make a point, and they had the organization, and they had the popular people, and you think of Jane Fonda. I can still take you to an armory men's room where they have a Jane Fonda urinal sticker in the urinal. I can show it to you right today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the sort of stuff. I feel sorry when I look through the books and I see the pictures of Colonel Eisner, who was my battalion commander, who was killed by a sniper.
Yeah.
Because I knew his wife. I knew him. In fact, I went and saw his wife, who for a number of years was the matchmaker, I should say, the hostess over at West Point, because he was a West Point graduate.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that the anti-Vietnam people used pictures like that to further their goals, mm-hmm. and the pro people used that to show so all this public support certain families were dragged through it by both sides.
Yeah.
I think it's a sad thing. The other thing that I think that is after the war that bothered me the most is suddenly the all this contriteness to make things right. Well, I don't think the government is the person that can make the things right.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that all this stuff that they're trying to do now to make the Vietnam veteran feel loved or something.
Yeah.
They're having parades all the place. They're doing Vietnam veteran memorials, mm-hmm. and all this stuff. Yet I think again they're doing it, and they're not doing it because when you go back and find the millions and millions of I don't know how many total million men went through Vietnam and women, but you probably know that answer better than I do. But the vast again by far, what, 95% of those people are someplace living in America, normal lives, and for the most part, don't consider them screwed up or anything else. And very few of them has ever had had a bad experience. I've got 30-some years of military, and I can't ever say, I tell you, I've never had a time when I had a bad experience with being in the military, public or private or otherwise. Well, I shouldn't say that. Probably I've had some unpleasant private times with my wife about being in the military, but those have passed by, fortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what's happened. So that is something that I don't know what they're trying to do. And maybe it's me again. Maybe it's just the way I'm seeing things. But for example, I have not. The only Vietnam movie I've seen is Apocalypse Now, and I've never read any books about it, and I don't particularly want to. I've no desire to go back to Vietnam because I saw what it was like in '72, what was left of it, how the jungles around the lot were basically gone and defoliated, and I've seen pictures of it since, and it hasn't come back. And I remember what it was like. I want to remember it, what the lot was like when I first saw it. I want to remember the Iron Triangle, what it was like when I was over there in '65, which was a true triple canopy jungle and was gorgeous, and the wildlife, and actually seeing a tiger and seeing wild elephants and things like that. I mean, that's what I want to. And the monkeys and everything that was there, and that's what I want to remember. I don't want to remember what it looked like in the '70s when they've gotten done with defoliation and bombing, and because they pretty much changed the beautiful country into something that, you know, like a tornado went through a place. A conversation like this I've had with you, I've never really had this with anybody else before. Certainly, it's not the conversations that I have in the guard, even now or in the past. It's not a conversation that you would hear at the at our flight school meetings. You know, the gatherings there. You heard those conversations. You know, and what you heard was probably what you would have heard if you'd been there the year before and the year before that. It doesn't change anything, but this is something that is, first time I've really talked about it. I've often wondered what's happened to some of these guys, that I knew. You know, I sometimes wonder what happened to Sergeant Lynch, because I liked him. I certainly wonder what happened to Sergeant Cotton. What happened to him if some husband didn't track him down and do him in. I think of the doc that we had, Doc Klein. I wonder where he is, because we sort of got on together, you know, there was a guy by the name of Fred Begwin, and a guy by the name of Dunn, who took over the recon platoon after it got wiped out. I wonder what happened to those guys. Those were funny guys. They were really funny characters, and they all had their take on life. You know, and you wonder how they're doing. Guys I flew with, you know, I can think of some guys that there was a major there that I every night drank himself to oblivion. And then he got so that I was ops officer. I was a captain. And it got so we didn't even scare him to fly anymore.
Wow.
But it was. But you wonder, you know, what happens to these guys? What they're doing? How their life is normal? Or what's happening with them? It's like they dragged out this old Air Force guy that was the guy that holds the record for the longest free fall in the. And the highest jump from 100-some thousand feet, parachute jump, they dragged him out, and he said that he first time maybe I asked him about it in 40 years, you know. So it was, but I don't know what you're finding. I I would think that probably most of these interviews are fairly upbeat. Most of them feel positive about their experience. Some probably don't. I don't know. I would say that if you talk to anybody that stayed involved with the military afterwards, that they probably have a very positive feeling about it. I mean, everybody's going to have those things that they're unhappy about, or they're scared the hell out of them. And I know guys that were shot down 4 or 5 times, mm-hmm. but they were. But you look at them and they have relatively normal lives.
Mm-hmm. It runs the gamut, but yeah. You're right. There's for those men who stayed in the military, they seem to have an easier time integrating and their experiences and going from either Vietnam back to the United States or transitioning from a wartime army to peacetime army.
Yeah.
They have an easier time dealing with their experiences.
You saw most of our flight school. Mm-hmm. Most of my flight class you've met. Mm-hmm. There was that's 90% of the flight class practically mm-hmm. there. There's a couple guys dead and a couple guys didn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
But I look at that crew, and out of even 27 guys, I mean, there isn't one in the lot there that has not
mm-hmm.
done well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I mean, I find that amazing. It's just like all of my friends from college, we're all still married to the same woman we married. Mm-hmm. I mean, either high school or college sweethearts. And I look around that about my flight class, and it was most of them got out of the Army when they came back from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But they've all had a good life of it. And I like to believe it was our synergies myself. How's mm-hmm. that? How's that for pure optimism? Huh? But it was, I thank you for doing this.
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking the time. Why don't I go ahead and officially end this
yep.
thing?
Okay, great.
So this will end the interview with Peter Faber.